work session to order. We have the supervisors here and the planning commission members here as well. And today is October the 18th, 1923. I'm going to call the Board of Supervisors to order, and Mr. Bailey is going to call his
Okay, the chairman, the planning commission now in session, October 18th, 2023.
All right, we will now stand and pledge allegiance and a moment of silence.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. I forgot to welcome people in the audience. I see citizens as well as county people who want to welcome you to this work session. This is quite a privilege for us to sit together and talk about the solar system. And we have a guest here, but I'm going to turn that over to Mr. Dahl to make the introduction.
Yep, and Madam Chair, we need just for the record to show that Mr. O'Brien for the board is not here at the meeting at this moment, but all five planning commissioners are here in attendance.
Okay,
for the record.
Thank you.
So thank you, supervisors. Like I said, this is just kind of really meant to be like an educational thing. You know, solar is kind of new. Solar projects are new coming to the county. We've got couple projects that are already have been submitted. So today we have Wayne Gunn, he's the chairman for the South Central Virginia Business Alliance and also project manager for Red Hills Excavating. And then we also have Skylar Zunk, CEO of Energy Right, and he's also the chair of the Virginia Solar Energy Development and Energy Storage Authority, and that's a Commonwealth appointed position.
Yes, sir, by the governor.
Yeah, by the governor. So we have two individuals here that kind of are fully in with solar. So I guess kind of the one piece is, let me kind of bring up this kind of brief presentation here. And again, from working with Mr. Gunn originally reaching out to the county, some original items and topics of discussion are on the screen here. And these are just kind of some broad scope things that the planning commission and the board could give a discussion on. So one is construction sequencing, two would be erosion and siltation control, three is viable slopes and gradients to assure proper vegetation, four, traffic control and logistic plans, five, realistic setbacks to aid in reducing scene projects, six, realistic setbacks from rivers and streams and property lines, seven, economic attributes, eight, safety concerns, training, and then nine, there is some things for fiber in place too. So that's kind of just some general things that we could discuss. Also, I requested the board and planning commission to come up with some questions, so we received those by Friday, and those questions were submitted to Mr. Gunn and to Mr. Zunk as well. At a little before 3 o'clock today, and what you also have in front of you too, there was three documents that Mr. Zunk with Energy Right provided. You have hard copies in front of you. One is it's a report. Let's see, real quick here. The other one, so that's a report from, I think it's Weldon Cooper Center, if I remember correctly. Yeah, it's about decommissioning utility scale solar facilities. And then there's this, from Energy Ready Utility Scale Solar Ordinance Standards that we can discuss, and that's a one-page thing. And then the third document is really levelizing costs for solar energy, and I think Mr. Zunk could kind of speak about that as well. Again, this is really meant to be kind of informational for both bodies, and just kind of really kind of get some questions answered that that, you know, that maybe the board and planning commission is already not aware of. So, Madam Chair, happy to start however you want. If you want to get some of these real kind of general questions answered, or if you want to kind of jump into the questions that the board had specific questions on, and then they can, you know, obviously as time goes on, it'll just, I'm sure, spawn additional questions.
And can I just mention what this other document is? Mm-hmm. So that map shows, based upon the research of the Nature Conservancy, everything in blue is what you would call prime real estate in Silver. As far as topography, the transmission lines, and so on. So if you look in that map, if you see the dotted black line, that's transmission lines. And so you see that has to be more than 3/4 of Urbana County seems to be prime real estate when it comes to Silver. So, and then for the citizens, we put the board up on the end of the table over there.
Thank you. Yep. Thank you, Chris. Would you all like to start off with your questions, or would you want to do those that you have on their screen? What do you think would be best? Do you want to make the presentation and have questions?
I would say let's go through the presentation.
Okay. Another thing is, after it's over, and this is from 5 to
6. So 6:30.
Yeah, hour and a half.
Yeah,
absolutely.
After that, we should have maybe some conversation of where do we want to go from here? I mean, you know, how, what did we learn? Do we feel better about it? Do we need additional information so that we can kind of leave here knowing, you know, what we want to do?
Yeah, and just for the board and the planning commissions, they don't really have a presentation. This was more to really kind of get their kind of information from their experience working in solar mm-hmm. projects and kind of different capacities. So there's not a big presentation for them to go through. Okay. It's really to kind of have the dialogue, have your questions answered, and then kind of go from there. Again, I feel it'll spur more questions along the way too.
Yes. Now, if you want to ask a question, I will identify you so that you can go ahead and speak, so we won't be kind of talking over each other, because I know it's a big group here and we have a lot of things on top of it. So who would like to start?
You know, Madam Chair, I wonder if it would be helpful just to start with the very specific questions that were asked specifically, and make sure that we can kind of certainly get that mm-hmm. piece and then kind of go from there.
Okay.
So, I mean, Mr. Gunn, Mr. Zonke, you want to kind of come up here. And then again, so I sent those questions to you all last Friday, and so the questions that were submitted are, this is just one set. We have a second stream of questions as well.
I'm Lane Gunn. I'm the chairman and board of directors of the South Central Virginia Business Alliance, and I'm also a project manager and estimator for Red Oak Excavating Incorporated.
And my name is Skyler Zunk. Thank you for that kind introduction. Wearing a couple different hats here this evening, but very much looking forward to the conversation. A little over a year ago, a colleague and I founded Energy Right as a nonprofit to help educate rural Virginia on the best practices surrounding solar development to make sure if it happens, when it happens, rural Virginia is getting the best possible deal that they possibly can. So we have a keen eye for good policies and good projects. That's what we want to support, but we're here to educate. So it's a huge honor to be in front of you this evening. We've had the chance to meet with boards, planning commissions in this sort of scenario on a number of different occasions. So we're really excited for it.
Okay, audience, can you hear? So you need to get closer to the mic.
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
No, I can't.
I'm turning it up. Turn it up.
Check the battery.
Mic check.
Yes. All right, so we took both of you all talk and chat in the mic.
How's this now, folks?
If not, you may have to move up.
You got lots of seats close up, both towards the front.
Yes.
So I'll have.
Much better on Zoom.
Much better on Zoom.
I'm happy to take this first question and lay into my backup if you guys stump me. First question, just for the benefit of the audience and for folks listening, what are the total federal and state government subsidies for a utility scale solar farm receives in Virginia? And if you have this in front of you, the levelized cost of electricity report is going to be what I'm speaking to here. But first off, the solar projects do not receive any sort of state subsidy. In fact, they pay taxes, which I know you guys are talking about your siting agreements coming up on some potential projects and how the county wants to make money from solar projects with taxation. There's no money coming from any state body for these solar projects. They pay local taxes. It's a common misconception, but a huge added benefit. Solar projects, much like power generation systems using different technologies, fossil fuels, nuclear, you name it, do take advantage of federal energy subsidies. These are most commonly referred to as investment tax credits or production tax credits. It's not all too dissimilar to how the federal government has said if you put a solar system on your roof, you will get a 30% tax credit money back from your tax bill at the end of the year. These systems definitely take advantage of those. It's sometimes an unfair criticism of solar projects, particularly because almost every single type of electricity generation, every sort of power, every sort of energy that we use does take advantage of some sort of federal subsidy. For up to me, no energy sources would get any subsidy, but it's the world we live in, and the levelized cost of electricity report compares the cost of a unit of energy produced from a solar project versus a gas project versus a nuclear project. Even without subsidies, solar is the cheapest way to put a new electron on the grid. That was not the case 5 or 10 years ago, and that's why this is new. It's newly very profitable to build projects and harness the energy that they produce. Once you build them, you don't have to pay for the fuel, and that's different compared to a bunch of other energy generations that we've relied on in the past. What else would you add, Wayne?
You pretty much covered everything on that one. Of course, their main question we'll get into afterwards is about the Inflation Reduction Act, but that's basically boils it down. The accurate number that you could actually get, you'd have to do it by project basis. You can't just sit there and say, oh, it's this amount, because they're all different sizes, they're all different locations, they all cost a different amount of money to do it. You know, they can add, I think it's 10% that can be added for additional tax credit if all the products are manufactured in the United States or domestically. And then I think they can get, it's 10% more tax credit if the project is located in what's considered an energy community. So that, you know, they can get a good tax credit, but it's on the federal level, not the state. And you would actually benefit from the taxes through your tax rate that you'd be charging to the solar projects themselves. So it's beneficial to the counties more than it is really anybody else.
It's a good point. So the final answer there is the base 30% with the potential to do a plus 10% if you are siting these projects with American-made materials, or if you're in an energy community, or if you're committing to paying the prevailing wage, high wages. This is all built into the recent bill that Washington passed, the Inflation Reduction Act, where a lot of these terms were recently solidified. Before we move on, any immediate questions from Supervisors Planning Commission?
How would you define, what is specifically is an energy community? And is that established at the state, federal level?
It's established at the federal level, and the purpose of putting that into the bill a couple years ago is to help address environmental justice concerns. If a community had been saddled with a coal plant, that would be considered an energy community, and they want to incentivize converting those retiring fossil fuel assets into renewable energy projects. So I don't know the specific definitions. That's generally what it is, an energy community is one that has produced energy historically, and one that they want to make sure is highlighted for the economic benefits that these projects bring in the future.
So, just one question. So the county had a former Brema power plant that was an old coal-producing plant. Would that potentially be considered an energy community then in that area, potentially? Or would you go to the federal site to see what that is?
Potentially. I think it's highly likely that it would be considered an energy community. I do not know for sure. Yeah. I think when developers are trying to find land to put these things, they're aware that there's this extra 10% bonus that they could get if they site it there. So it's certainly a big aspect there. And in Southwest Virginia, there's many energy communities I know because of all the coal that they've produced historically, and a lot of folks are looking to Southwest Virginia for that. But I'd say Brema would probably qualify. I do not know for sure.
And also with what I've seen Dominion doing in the past and what their plan was on several coal-fired plants, unless they've changed it this year, was to actually utilize the coal-fired plants as switchyards for solar if they were decommissioned or were decommissioned in the past. So that would definitely be a question to ask Dominion if they were to come to your county, if they were going to utilize the Brema plant for such switch yards or switch gears and what have you. As basically it would be a massive substation / storage facility.
Are these energy communities anywhere based on the average non-renewable megawatt hours used per person? I know in Fluvanna, it's 132.82 megawatt hour per person non-renewable energy.
I'm not quite understanding, but I'm not sure
there's... Is it based on the fact that a lot of non-renewable energy is being used? Could that be a reason that it's considered an energy community?
I don't think
so. Where it
so.
Needs to reduce, if I give an extra 10% to reduce the non-renewable energy usage.
Now, typically, what an energy community is considered as would be one that's already generating electricity. In other words, where a coal-fired plant is, nuclear plant, or something of that nature, where it could be gas or it could be wood, as in South Boston and Emporia, Greene County, what have you. It could be anything along that nature. I don't believe that it has anything to do with energy consumption in the community. Because if that was the case, then Richmond would definitely be one. Yeah.
So it's purely where fossil fuel plants were producing energy historically, not so much on the consumption side.
You mentioned something about Inflation Reduction Act. Could you explain what that is? Is that a federal program?
Yes.
Sorry,
ma'am.
What did you say? What reduction?
Inflation Reduction.
Yes, the Inflation Reduction Act. It's if you wait a few minutes or a few questions, it's actually in here. Someone asked how it related to it or what the impact was on solar projects.
Okay. Any other questions?
Well, sticking to subsidies, so can a solar company typically be profitable without the federal subsidies?
Yes, sir.
That's question number two.
Perfect. Excellent timing. If I may, I'd like to draw your attention to the levelized cost of energy, call it the Lazard study.
And I have that up on the screen and then on all of it. So if you know what page you go to, I can go to it.
Yep, let me take a look here. All right, this is going to be page 5.
That page right there?
No, sir. It's going to say levelized cost of energy comparison, unsubsidized analysis.
That one right there.
Yes, perfect. So this is how much a unit of electricity costs without subsidies, no matter if you're subsidizing oil and gas, no matter if you're subsidizing wind, nuclear, period. This is an unsubsidized analysis. I mentioned earlier, federal government has said that they're going to subsidize everything somehow, some way. This takes away all of that. So if you look here, solar PV utility scale, the third line down, it says $24 to $96, and that's the cost per megawatt hour of electricity produced. That's pretty low. If you scroll down, you have gas peaking plants, and that's, we have several of those in the state, and those aren't meant to be utilized all the time, but when they do run to meet peak demand, they're costing $115 to $221 per megawatt hour. Nuclear is there next, and that range is $141 to $221. Coal, $68 to $166. Gas combined cycle gets to be pretty competitive, $39 to $101. We really dig into this. This came out this past spring. The one in 2022 had a very similar story. Coming into this conversation, I want to be clear. We're an all-of-the-above energy organization. We're never going to say anything bad about any form of electricity because we need all of it. The more we have, the cheaper it's going to be. Let's make sure everything has a fair seat at the table. This unsubsidized analysis demonstrates that solar can be very cost-effective, but it's an intermittent resource. It's not going to be the one form of electricity that we can completely rely on, but when we do rely on it, as that slice of the pie increases in size, it's going to be very cost effective. You know, it's tied for onshore wind, you know, on its lower threshold.
So can I add to that question then?
Yes, sir.
As you were just saying, so then you do still have to have fossil fuel electricity to back up solar, right? Because it is intermittent. And
so solar does not power anything at nighttime. So some folks are seeing the future as including battery storage in that scenario. There's not terribly much in Virginia so far. So right now, you know, it's a bright day. Solar is producing quite a bit in Virginia, up to about 5%. Certainly, when the sun goes down and those assets are not producing energy with sunshine, you got to fill that with something. Yeah. Right now in Virginia, you know, I mentioned earlier, 5% about with solar, and then the way Dominion sometimes describes it is a quarter nuclear. We're not too far from Louisa, so it's safe to say that this area is pretty much predominantly a large percentage is nuclear, part natural gas, part coal. And then when you really, really need it, I believe the last quarter is heating oil, which is really expensive. So that's kind of the way that these pie slices work out in Virginia right now. Solar is going to be increasing in its size. It's not the one solution. So yes, you're going to need to, in the short term, the grid operator for the region is having to pull energy from different sources when solar is not producing as much as is being demanded.
So does that mean then that it's actually whatever the cost of solar is, if you have to have fossil and solar, if you're going to have solar and you have to have fossil as backup, does that mean then that the solar option is actually much more expensive because you do have to have both?
No, sir, because when it is being produced, it is at a very, very low cost. You're not shipping in coal, piping in gas. It's an incredible complement. At this stage in Virginia, that's how I would consider it. There's a reason that companies, to include Dominion and private developers, are pouring billions of dollars into solar. And it's not the investment tax credit, it's that it's producing energy very cheaply, that they can sell at the market rate. If it was increasing costs and not allowing that power producer to have a decent profit margin, folks wouldn't be investing so heavily in it. So I think it is an incredible complement when these assets are producing during the daytime. They're producing energy extraordinarily cheaply, and that complements other forms of electricity very well.
But you do still have to have both. So it just seems like to me that there's two layers of expense there. Although the solar on itself is shown to be cheap, if you have to have the fossil fuel too to support it, the fossil energy, then you have redundant costs there. Wouldn't that be?
No, because for every kilowatt hour that you get from solar is less expenditure on the coal side versus running coal, gas, wood, fuel, whatever the case may be to generate electricity, hydroelectric, nuclear, whatever. Every kilowatt hour that's made by solar, you know, if you look at the chart, you know, your utility scale solar is 24 to 96. If you go down to gas peaking, it starts at 115. Okay? So for every, right now it's 5%. So it's for every kilowatt hour that you make solar, you're basically saving $91 per kilowatt hour. So it's more cost effective, and they can still sell that electricity at whatever the peak market rate is, because an electron sells for whatever it goes for on the grid. So Dominion would be saving money. So in that response, you know, Northam, of course, started this and has mandated that Dominion go green by 2050. There's no way to kill all other power plants, fossil fuel power plants. There's just no way. Yeah. Because solar can't do it. There's no way to ramp it up when you need it other than storing it in batteries. All right? And in the long run, if Dominion can get, you know, 30, 35, 40% into the power grid through solar, then everybody benefits because your power bill is going to drop because it costs them less to make the electricity that we use every day. For every solar farm that you can bring to your county, you know, by kilowatt or gigawatt, megawatt, however the size of the project is, whether it's 20 acres on Uncle Fred's farm or it's 500 acres on somebody else's place, you know, that's tax revenue to the county every single year, not only just from the developer slash owner, Dominion, or whoever it may be, it's also taxable as property tax. So you can sit there and when you make your solar ordinances and what have you, you can set your personal property taxes a specific tax for land that's used in solar. It doesn't just have to be based on your current land values on somebody's house or car or whatever. You can put your percentage out there that you want to collect on land that's in solar panels. You can adjust everything by that. So, I mean, in the long run, it's a win-win for everybody. Dominion's saving money and getting to sell it at a higher profit. The county's making money off of taxation and metered electricity, or however you want to set your ordinance up. So, I mean, at the end of the day, solar is the cheapest way to go.
Does that answer your question, Mr. Fairchild? I could try an analogy,
I see the point that when the energy is burning, or being delivered, it's cheaper in solar. So the actual energy, it seems like it's cheaper, but there is redundancy in infrastructure. If you have solar, that's infrastructure, the panels and so on. Then you have nuclear or coal-fired power plant. You know, both of those have to be paid for too. And so it just seems that there's some redundancy in infrastructure, which has a cost, while the electricity itself would be cheaper than coming from solar.
That's a really interesting perspective. I see what you mean. Right now there's a lot of redundancy because we're, you know, these lights are on, currently being powered by nuclear, gas, coal, probably not much solar right now, but multiple different sources. I drove my 13 mile a gallon Jeep here today. When I'm going on a long distance trip, I take the Honda Civic. I get 35 miles per gallon. Using my Honda is not increasing my costs of having that Jeep. I am picking and choosing when to use both resources. The cheapest possible time, when I'm going for the cheapest possible trip, I'm going to take the Honda. when the Honda's not going to pull a trailer or I'm not going to take it off-road, I take the more expensive, you know, to operate Jeep, if that makes sense. That's how I think about it. Please.
That's a good comparison. Thank you.
Any other comments, questions?
I think that also maybe not everybody quite understands it.
Get a look.
I'm not sure that everybody quite understands that energy companies use peak production and they sell off their energy as well too. And so there, you know, there is always a level of energy that is higher than what they are actually producing at any given point in time that they have available to them. Because say during the summertime when you've got everybody using their air conditioners on a day of 120 degrees, there's a peak energy demand. And when that peak energy demand happens, energy companies will buy energy from another energy company who doesn't have that peak demand at that point in time. And that's where they end up paying these extra dollars. So there's kind of a bartering system that happens that I think a lot of the public doesn't understand. And feel free to correct me on that.
No, you're right. You're right. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, Dominion has to buy power from companies in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, you know, wherever across the state to power Virginia. You know, this solar projects basically let them make it right here at home. And having storage facilities, aka batteries, in their solar projects allows them to store it and be able to sell that excess energy off. But, you know, a lot of energy is put right straight into the grid or your main transmission lines and goes straight on into the grid and is used. You know, I've been to several counties that they said, well, why have we got to bring solar to our county? They're just going to sell it to somebody else. You know, excess power may be sold to somebody else. But a lot of these projects power the communities that they're built in because it doesn't have to go anywhere. When an electron goes into your power grid, it doesn't care if it's going east, west, north, south, wherever. It's going to go where the demand is pulling it to. You know, the only way it can be metered is through the larger facilities, switchgear yards, yada, yada, yada. But at the end of the day, most of it's going right there where the solar farm is built because that's where the immediate draw is going to be. You see what I'm saying? So if you don't have any solar projects in your county, then they close down fossil fuel plants around you. Well, all the other counties have to sell you electricity. So if it all has to come into your county and Dominion has to meter it, then it could raise your light bill because there's nothing there to produce your own locally. You see what I'm saying? So it's a driving force there to where everybody kind of pulls their own weight across the state to help yourselves out versus not having it. And then you're basically stuck with a higher light bill and the citizens are definitely not going to like that.
On the state level, I know this is a huge priority for the governor, is just to produce more energy in Virginia, period. We import from our neighbors about 4 gigawatts of electricity to power Virginia every single day. If we want to be an independent, energy independent country, we need to start by being an energy independent state, and that translates into being an energy independent or energy exporting locality. I don't want to buy more electricity from West Virginia and give those folks more revenue on every ounce of energy that they sell us. I think the benefits should be recognized as locally as possible.
Okay. Any other comments?
We'll go to the next question on the list here.
And it's, what is the cost for proper tear down, shipment, and recycling or disposal of solar panels?
So this is why I provided you all with a copy of the Virginia, excuse me, the University of Virginia's Weldon Cooper Center. In August of last year, the Weldon Cooper Center, which think of it as a think tank, think of it as a center to advise local governments across Virginia, based in obviously Charlottesville, put together this report to make recommendations to counties on how to properly put in policies so that these projects are decommissioned when they need to be at the end of their useful life. solar projects tend to ask for permits and live for, or have a useful life of 30 to 40 years. At the end of that lifetime, in 40 years, the panels that we install today will still be operating at 70 to 80% of their original capacity. So those things are, in 40 years, are still going to be producing electricity, but not as much as they did on day one, if that makes sense. So a lot of folks are thinking about this as, what are we going to do with those panels when the best use case for them is not to sit in a sunny field, but maybe they go on schools. Maybe there's a secondhand market to sell them to individuals to put on their own roofs. If those things are still producing electricity, I think a lot of folks are going to create businesses in a couple of decades to repurpose those as technology improves and those projects are decommissioned. So there's still value in those panels that folks don't often appreciate. It's certainly not going to be a junkyard. And having a smart decommissioning plan helps to make sure that that happens. The study is rather lengthy, but there's a couple of key points that I would like to make sure are mentioned here. Number one is just making sure that the that decommissioning language is involved either in a project permit or in a solar ordinance that a county adopts. That is the first hurdle that the Weldon Cooper Center advises counties to do. The other is to ask for a financial surety bond up front to tell that the owner of that facility to put up money at the very beginning of the project's life, to be held in bond or in escrow, to grow over time, to fund the removal of the panel infrastructure at the end of that time frame. This matters to more people than just folks at the county government level. This matters to the landowners. They want to make sure that their land is returned to the original state or better at the end of a project's life. We think that's incredibly important, and our advice within our ordinance standards document mirrors what the Weldon Cooper Center came up with. At the very end of the report,
hang on a second.
Sure, go ahead.
The key word to use in your ordinance when you're discussing your decommissioning bond is irrevocable. I can't stress that enough. You make sure that it's an irrevocable bond. And what that means is it doesn't matter if this developer sells it to this developer, sells it to this developer, they can sell it 20 times. At the end of the day, that bond has to be assumed by whoever buys the project. It's irrevocable. It could be not be done away with. All right, and then as this project lives in your community over the 25, 30, 40, 50 years, whatever the case may be, if it's leased, the landowner will have input in how it's decommissioned at the end of life for these projects. That's the main reason why Dominion leases the land, or the developer will lease the land so that they stay in contact throughout the life of the project and is put back to their liking. Okay? But your bond can be readdressed, and Skylar, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but many boards stipulate the bond has to be redone or reevaluated every 3 years for cost increases. That's something to keep in mind on these projects. Reevaluate your bond every 3 years. If it has to go up, make them take it up. Put it in your siting agreement, conditional use permit, you know, whatever the case may be, where you need it. That's where you want to make sure you put irrevocable bond and address how often you want that bond to be reviewed.
Many counties, including Louisa, have made that reassessment process every 5 years. Not terribly much is going to change between year one and year five. I think they also did that to lighten the load on staff a bit, but renewing it, making sure that updated estimates for the complete removal of these panels and all of that infrastructure is good policy. Mr. Dahl, if we could go to page 47. This is a map accurate as of last year. I'm sure that it has changed, but...
Is it document page 47?
Yes,
or the PDF 40, okay.
Document 47.
It's Looking for green and white?
Yes, there you are.
There we go.
So Fluvanna is not highlighted, and that means that Fluvanna at last year, at the time that this was published, did not have either a utility-scale solar decommissioning ordinance nor locally codified financial assurity requirements that Lane just mentioned. Many counties with more solar experience than Fluvanna, to be candid, in the south side of Virginia, do have these requirements within their ordinance. So we want every county to be up to speed on this decommissioning language. I think when we talk about taking care of rural Virginia, we need to make sure that we are returning these parcels of land to their original condition or better. And sorry to harp on that, but there's a lot of things that these projects do, which are increasing the soil health, increasing the usability of this land for their landowners over that period of time. That's super important. I know that some counties that are not highlighted here have put decommissioning language and financial assurity language into individual project permits. So some that aren't highlighted have decommissioning experience, but maybe not an official ordinance on the matter.
May I ask, did you say that solar is improving the ground, the soil quality?
I would defer to some of my farmer friends who would talk your ear off for many hours and let you tour their farm, but yes. A lot of times, if it's a pine plantation, that's pretty acidic soil and not necessarily the best quality. If it's in agriculture, you tend to add additives to the soil, fertilizer, tilling that soil to make sure that it is as fertile as possible. Imagine a solar project is letting that land lie fallow. You're not tilling it. You're not adding fertilizer to it or soil amendments on a very regular basis. And if you have a agrivoltaic component, if you have sheep grazing underneath it, that's a layer of manure for the entire length of that project, where those sheep are actually selecting for the food that they want to eat and redepositing those same minerals back into the soil. Our agrivoltaic partners that are members of Lane's organization, the Business Alliance, would be very happy to tell you all of the science stuff. It's not my background, but relatively passive land use that does have, when it does have a grazing component, can significantly add to the soil health.
But understanding most of them don't have a grazing component right now, so if they don't have the grazing component, is there anything that's improving the soil? Because my understanding has been by the fact that if they're not getting access to the sun and so on, all the natural things that happen, that if a panel's over top of that, then it degrades the soil quality.
No, sir. When the project is constructed, DEQ requires a minimum 95% vegetative cover on the project before they'll accept it. So the EPC, or the main general contractor over the project, has to ensure a minimum of 95% vegetative cover. Now, what they have done, especially Dominion projects, they have created seed blends that promote pollination. They plant them for bees, butterflies, any type of pollinator. They're going with that type of vegetation, clovers, lespedezas, you name it. I mean, I've seen an area with no quail in it. Next thing you know, there's quail living on a solar farm. There's turkeys nested in a solar farm. The wildlife don't pay it any attention. It's a smorgasbord for most of them, because humans can't get in the fence except the O&M guys. Okay, but at the end of the day, at the end of the day, you take a pine plantation. Once you plant pines, I don't care if it's on the best cornfield in the world. When you plant pines on that piece of property, they naturally turn the soil acidic over time. I have seen and had to personally put in anywhere from 3 to 6 tons, and yes, that's tons, of lime in topsoil from pine plantations to get grass to grow. So solar projects, in my opinion, they've got to have vegetation growing under them, around them, in the ponds, in the side ditches, everything else before they're accepted by the Department of Environmental Quality, DEQ. All right? Pine plantations don't have that. They get pine tags and scrub brush growing underneath them. Yeah, it's great deer habitat, but when they start growing 40 foot tall, you got a pine desert. Squirrels eat pine cones, and that's going to be about it.
Thank you.
All right, go ahead, Scott.
That was about it. I'm not a scientist, not a soil expert, but toured farms that have a grazing component. And it's really interesting. They will put out a box of minerals that you would recognize, magnesium, potassium, you name it, sodium, and they're individually labeled. The sheep will self-select what mineral they are lacking based on its smell. They will go lick a salt block, for lack of a better term, and then redeposit that into the soil. So if there's not enough magnesium in the soil to produce plants and ground cover with magnesium for the sheep, they're going to lick that block and redeposit it back in. So it's part of a multi-year process. It takes a few years for agrivoltaics to take hold. You have to weed out some of the invasive species. You got to make sure that the plants that are living there are suitable for the sheep. But it's a really interesting scenario. You're right, there's many projects that don't have agrivoltaics. The farmer that I was with for the past 2 days is grazing 3,000 acres in Lane's neck of the woods. But he also has got a project in Louisa County. He's traveling the state. There are several grazers that I could think of that are have little pockets of where they are grazing projects, you know, within a few county radius. And it's a practice that is cheaper because you're not having to hire landscaping folks to weed eat under these panels. It's a few person operation, and then it creates a new agriculture product, which farmers are really excited about.
And you can't use goats. They'll chew on the wire. You got to go with sheep.
I've raised sheep for 40 years, and there is some things that you have to do for them. Every year you're going to have to shear them. And somebody has to, in the winter, you have to feed them. And so I'm not sure that it's not going to be painless to
it's not.
Take care of them. You've got a responsibility to them.
I wish I had sent this because I printed off 25 copies of it earlier. We're doing another event in Campbell County right now with some solar grazers who are telling the board members down in Campbell County just about this. It's predominantly hair sheep instead of wool sheep in Virginia. I'm not aware of a solar project that has wool sheep on it to date. So there's no shearing requirement. But these farmers do retain a 24-hour vet in case there are any issues whatsoever. They have requirements to be on these sites at least every 48 hours with at least two members of their staff. So it's certainly not a pick them up in 3 months sort of deal. They are constantly there checking on their sheep, rotationally grazing them from section to section to section to make sure that they're high density grazing. And if they do need to supplement with hay during the winter, they can. I'm not sure how frequent that is.
Well, from what I've talked to them at a million when they were down there, a lot of times when the vegetation goes dormant, they take the sheep out of the solar farm anyway because they don't need. There's going to be nothing there for them to graze.
Right.
Then they'll bring them back in the spring when it starts reemerging. So it's definitely their livestock, but they treat them like pets. I mean, they really do. It's unreal. The guy will talk your ear off for weeks if you let him.
Be careful if you invite him.
Yeah. They really do. I've got labs at the house that live like little kings. The sheep do the same thing. They're in their element. It's like Skylar said, they're a hair sheep. They're not a wool shearable sheep, so it's a little bit different breed. And they're well suited. They've got shade all over the place, plenty of water, plenty of food, you know, between clovers and Johnson grass and all the other pollinators that they make a plant when they build these projects. And it's just everything from less Lespediza to you name it. You know, so they're well taken care of.
Okay. Are we ready for question four?
I feel like if there was any gotcha question here, it would be number four. So raise your hand if you wrote it down. I figured, Mr. Fairchild, but do you know the name and location of the last fully decommissioned utility-scale solar farm in the U.S. in the southeast? A short answer is no. Like I mentioned earlier, these projects are newly profitable, newly as in the last 10 years. So you did not see the utility-scale deployment of this technology in the early 2000s, in the 90s, in the 80s, in the 70s. I mentioned also earlier these projects last 30 to 40 years, and that's their typical life cycle. So to my knowledge, without scouring Google for some probably unreliable points, I'm not aware of one that's been fully decommissioned in America. In Europe, there are. And I know folks are looking at them, trying to perfect that decommissioning model and implement that here in the States, but there's not been a market need for it. Again, in 20, 25 years, I think the decommissioning of these projects and where those panels go and how they're recycled, it's going to be a booming business. Lane and I probably will start one in a couple decades because it's going to be huge.
Coming 2024.
You're going to need to rapidly do this at scale. That financial surety bond really helps with that. But you know, Lane can probably talk about the mechanics of what it would take to remove those piles. But on a lot of projects, there's nothing underground except for those piles, those, you know,
DC cable and NB cable, you know, those things, yeah.
And some, he's mentioning some projects bury some wires, some projects keep them above ground. It depends on the type of soil and where the project is. But the short answer to that is no. It's an incredibly important thing. I think recycling is going to be a huge business. The largest American manufacturer of panels is based in Arizona, manufactures in Ohio, and will soon manufacture in Louisiana and Alabama. A company called First Solar. They already recycle the panels that they produce. They've deemed it in their business interest to recover some of those valuable ingredients within a panel. They take the glass off, they make them into beer bottles in Toledo, they reuse the active ingredients for future panels, and I think you're going to see a lot more businesses start to do that. Instead of, you know, mining for these materials, recycle them, repurpose them. By weight, a solar panel is mostly glass, a bit of aluminum, some steel, that's 90% of it. The last 10% is a little bit more difficult to recycle, but it's definitely doable. Folks are doing it right now.
If I could say, in part, the reason I ask is, and I might get some part of this wrong, but I had heard that the state of North Carolina, the legislature basically was, they commissioned, that they set out a project for staff to return a report that says, okay, here's throughout the life cycle, here's how you recycle it at the end, here's how long you can expect it to last, and so on. And that basically staff came back to the government and said, you're looking for a report that we can't yet produce because there hasn't been enough decommissioning and so on for us to say definitively, here's what the backside looks like. Have you all heard anything about anything like that? Or?
Well, North Carolina's been working on it because they've been in the solar industry a little bit longer than we have in Southern Virginia. But basically, China and France have the biggest recycling facilities, right? There's 15 of them in the United States right now, one of the biggest being in Arizona, right? And basically, your solar panels are an aluminum frame. They've got a machine that pops it off. It goes into a bin for aluminum. Then they've got a vibratory press that actually cracks all the glass. It runs through the press twice, or two presses in line, and that pops the glass off. Then you're left with electrical grade silicone. right? The electrical grade silicone is the very expensive part because that's specific to solar panels. So they either harvest that and reuse it, or they'll sit there and they grind it all into what's called cullet, which is a mixture of the glass, silicone, silver, tin, lead. And yes, there is a little bit of cadmium in some solar panels, but it is below EPA guidelines, so it's not considered a hazardous material. So when you're disposing of these in a landfill, you can get certifications stating that they're not hazardous materials because it's not of quantity that would be hazardous to the environment that you're putting them in. All right? But when they recycle them, China and France really have it narrowed down to where they can actually get the silver, copper, tin, lead, the whole nine yards, separate. We don't have those machines in the United States yet. They are available for purchase on the market, but you're looking at about a $7 million investment just to get them here. All right, so there's, I know seven companies right now that are designing these machines to be able to do this. Most of your plants in America grind it into cullet and then resell the cullet. And that normally sells for $3 to $10 per hundred. It's got a market just like steel, aluminum, everything else. So there's a recyclability there, but it's not at the level that the countries like France, China, and all have already in place because they've been doing it way longer than we have. So that's just something to keep in mind. The technology in America is going to catch up, and of course, because we're America, it's going to go beyond. But at the end of the day, we're going to be able to handle these things in 20 years when the decommissioning comes. But as far as damaged panels and what have you, during construction or if one gets broken, hailstorm, 50, whatever the case may be, there's 15 recycling plants in the continental United States, contiguous 48 states, that can take them or they can be placed in a landfill. You know, one of the biggest things that I see at Board of Supervisors meetings in the objections from the communities is people fussing about cadmium in these things. All right? Cadmium, yes, it's a heavy metal. All right? But most people don't even know what cadmium is. Will it cause cancer? Yes, it can cause cancer. All right? But at the end of the day, you're talking about enough cadmium per solar panel. It's about an inch long and it's thin as a strand of hair. It's 0.0017 micrograms per panel. You know, that's way below what EPA or DEQ would consider a hazardous material.
Moving on.
Okay.
What would happen if you have a lot of panels and those small amounts continue to add up? Could that reach a certain threshold and provide any sort of harm to local communities or things like that?
What most solar farms do that I've been on, I've built five in the state of Virginia so far. What most of them do is they stockpile the panels that are damaged and they ship them to a recycling facility because a landfill charges way more to take them in bulk by weight than what the recycling facility will. But yes, if I was to send 200,000 solar panels to a landfill, then yes, the area in that landfill would probably be enough to be considered a hazardous material. But by per panel, no, it's not. All right, and I don't know what y'all know about building landfills, but landfills are built with a rubberized liner underneath of them. You dig a big pit in the ground, put in a rubberized liner, you put in a leachate system, which is a contained water that comes out of our normal everyday trash. Is it hazardous to the environment? You better believe it. But nobody ever says anything. It goes through a leachate system, comes into a stormwater management structure, and it goes into basically a sediment basin. You know, if you ever ride by a landfill and you see flames flying up, that's the methane produced by the landfill. You know, so that there's a lot of different things that's already in a landfill that we don't pay a minute's notice to. You know, but when you're talking solar panels in a landfill, These projects might generate 100 solar panels or 200 solar panels going to a local landfill in Fluvanna County.
That's mostly if they get broken during transportation or if they crack during, you know, installation. I toured one in Halifax County last month. It is 500-600 acres, and I asked the guys constructing it how many had broken so far, and he said 60. Now, would they still produce electricity? Yes. Would they produce as much as they need that panel to produce? No. So they're planning to send them back to that Ohio plant I mentioned earlier to recycle in there. I think, Mike, your question is almost pretty aligned with question number 5. What's the environmental impacts or hazards resulting from the worn-out weathered solar panels? You have the ultimate, the worst possible weather disaster that you could imagine up. It's probably happened before. There was a study out of Virginia Tech a couple of years ago looking into every time a solar project has been hit by a tornado, hit by a huge hailstorm, hit by a hurricane, an earthquake, and they measured, one, how many panels were broken at that point. Then they tested the ground underneath them. And Virginia Tech concluded that there was still nothing leaching out of the panels whatsoever. Nothing had really happened to them. They went in, removed them, and disposed of them how that project owner saw fit. So I'd be happy to follow up and share the Virginia Tech report with you all. It makes folks feel comfortable about the worst possible scenario. Folks aren't also, these project owners, it's not in their best interest to let a broken panel sit in the field not producing electricity. They could swap that thing out and be selling more electricity to the grid. So they've got computer systems that can remotely monitor when one single panel in a 100-acre field is not producing, and they can, with a very, you know, laser-like focus in into that one panel, remove it, replace it, and get everything 100% back up and operational. So we get the question a lot, but there's, you know, there's not a lot of truth to the fear-mongering about leaching panels, and folks should feel protected. I grew up on 50 acres in Chesterfield County. I'm the immediate neighbor now, my family is, to a 400-acre facility. We care about the water. We live in a well. Absolutely nothing to be fearful of. These things do not pollute. They sit quietly in a field. If there's ever an issue with them, if they're immediately removed, it's in everyone's best interest to keep them up and operational.
The thing to keep in mind, there are no liquids in solar panels. There are no gases in solar panels. Everything in the solar panel is in a solid state. It doesn't melt. Some will melt. Now, if there's a fire or something of that nature, that's a different scenario. But there's ways to combat that as well. And I'll get into that when I start talking about my topics that I sent with the letter. But at the end of the day, normal operation with these solar panels, there's nothing to leach. Rainwater cannot get inside a solar panel. It is sealed. It literally takes a grinder or a very sharp razor blade in a machine using compression technology to separate the silicone from the glass.
And they bathe it in acid. If you want one of these things to leach, you have to heat them up to 2,000 degrees. You have to put them in a bath of acid. And the EPA does this to measure, you know, the absolute, you know, worst case scenario. And Lane was kind of getting this at this earlier. The EPA has still said, after you heat it up to 2,000 degrees, put it in acid, grind it up, what comes out of it, it's still safe to go into landfill. And they call that the T-clip test, toxicity characteristic leaching procedure. Panels have to pass that test, and folks should feel good about that. These, you know, a lot of these folks who are going into this industry are doing it for environmental stewardship reasons. It's in everybody's best interest to preserve the environment, especially locally.
I think we've answered question 6.
I think 6 and 7.
And 7.
And
so we're in 8. Question 8.
We chatted a little bit about the Inflation Reduction Act earlier.
you know, that was a huge, huge bill, and a portion of it certainly impacts the solar energy with that investment tax credit. But, you know, these companies are certainly very happy about that, but it does not drive their profitability. They still produce electricity as cheaply or more cheaply than any other form can produce electricity in Virginia. So it's a big federal policy. I don't spend my days thinking about it, to be completely honest. We're making recommendations, teaching folks locally about the facts surrounding these projects. Personally, and my organization believes that those folks sitting up here are going to be the best possible people to make decisions about solar projects in the energy future for your own county. That's why it's so important. You guys are powering your own homes and businesses. Landowners want to bring these projects forward to pay significant taxes to the community and also a new way to earn income for themselves. So it's an important topic. I don't wake up and think about the IRA. I don't know that many people do, but certainly a piece of the puzzle.
I thought part of the Inflation Reduction Act was returning funds to families that went in more electricity and getting away from oil. And it was an amount of money that was going to be paid to families.
I think it was a $2 trillion bill. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of pieces of it. I have not read it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pieces that talk about energy efficiency and upgrading appliances for individuals who qualify. That very well may be a big part of it.
Okay.
So, quick question, Skylar. When you get something like that provides some sort of incentive, and you kind of got this, I think, at the state level too, with some of the siting agreements that state gave the localities the ability to enter into these siting agreements to sort of kind of provide that, what I view as a little nudge to like be more receptive to these projects. And then you've got federal legislation that, you know, either subsidizing or giving tax credits. So there's obviously, and I know that all forms of energy have some sort of, you know, you look somewhere, it's not always the invisible hand. You've got, you know, Uncle Sam under there somewhere, right? But if there's this much effort from the government to push these particular projects, what is it that's preventing them from, I don't want to say surviving on the free market, but not needing these sort of subsidies or tax credits to have that sort of nudge? Why does the state government say, well, we're going to allow, you know, localities to enter into siting agreements? You know, we were planning commission class this week and they talked about we're one of the most strict constructionist states when it comes to Dillon Rule. And, you know, they're giving us the ability to engage in these siting agreements and things to sort of push us along. So why is it that there's this much incentive being pushed by state and federal for?
Well, I'll take that. The federal government mandated green energy. States really didn't have much say-so in it in the beginning. Individual governors in different states all met together, what, about 5 or 6 years ago, and Northam was in office.
I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Basically, with solar, the state can't sit there and say, you're going to build one here. It has to go before the board of each county. So if they don't give you power to make those siting agreements and to be able to basically set your own destiny, they don't have any say-so. Because the solar industry isn't like VDOT. At this time, they can't come in with eminent domain and say, we're going to build a solar farm here, like VDOT can come in and say, we're going to give you $500 for your acre of land, we're going to build a road through your yard. It's best for the local community, it's best for the state, yada, yada, yada. VDOT has that power. Solar industry doesn't. Because Dominion, AEP, and our other energy providers are corporations. They're not owned by the state. So they have to go to local governments and give them some sort of power to make deals with them, to build these in the community.
Mike, you and I are both small government conservatives. I think about it this way. There are states to our south that do not have energy policies like Virginia does. Texas, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, do not have versions of the Clean Economy Act, but they're all beating us in solar development. In Texas, it is extraordinarily easy to build a wind project or a solar project or to drill for oil because they really, really respect property rights. You do not have to go before a county board in Texas. You just file your building permit, you interconnect it to the grid, and it's very easy. So Texas, Oklahoma have incredible amounts of solar and wind. And folks would think it's California, but Texas and Oklahoma and the states that I mentioned are all beating Virginia in this output. Let me tell a story about Lane's home county, Charlotte County, who 25 years ago said no, they did not want a coal power plant, Clover Power Plant in Charlotte County. So they sent it across the river to Halifax County. And I think every day since then, Charlotte County has kicked themselves because they're missing out on this incredible taxpayer that powers a big part of that region, this power plant. That power plant, just like any power plant, pays a significant amount of local taxes. I'm sure BREMO paid a fair deal of taxes to this locality. Solar is so profitable and is so successful on its own without subsidies that the state government a couple years ago said, not only do we need to prop this up anymore and make it a tax-free endeavor, do we need to give these folks a tax break? No, they should pay local taxes just like every other form of electricity generation pays. Nuclear, gas, coal, you name it. So I think it's a really good thing. Folks who want to propose these projects and want to build in the community, whether it's a gas plant or a solar plant, are going to pay local taxes at a significant rate above what that parcel of land would earn in agriculture, timber, you name it. And those are dollars that the county should negotiate for and should fight for. Lane's hometown is going to be making $5 million a year from a couple of solar projects that they passed a couple of years ago. That's a 33% increase to their county's bottom line with just this new taxpayer. Folks who sit where you are should be thinking about ways to invest that money in a very meaningful way, whether that's first responders, schools. There's a lot to be excited about. These projects are incredible taxpayers wanting to come into the community. They should be taxed from my perspective. Even small projects now with the legislation from this past year, below 5 megawatts can now be taxed. It's a big opportunity. I think it's pretty fair to ask these companies to pay taxes just like any other form of a power plant.
Mike, a few years ago, we passed a solar panel farm down near Zion's Crossroads. And at the time, there was no real tax incentive to the county to pass that. And my opinion was that it was not a good deal for the county because we were essentially taking land that was prime land that we had invested in bringing infrastructure to that area, and we were getting zero revenue back for it. So while it can be viewed maybe as an incentive, it can also be viewed as fair market use as well too. And that is to say that, you know, there is a cost to using the land somehow or another. And the county, when they're passing these projects, can expect to receive revenue, which is a plus now, as opposed to just letting that land, in that case, was simply agricultural. Same cost, agricultural cost. There was no change at all. And there's no revenue generation for the county at all.
Hey, we're running out of time. I've heard somebody else.
You know, the one thing, too, so we have Mr. Gunn's questions,
yes,
kind of that he had
right
in the letter. The one thing that I hear loud and clear in a lot of the solar meetings is regarding setbacks, buffers,
mm-hmm,
you know, things like
yes
that. So maybe,
yes,
I think that would be important to kind of maybe address,
right,
certainly, because that's the community talks loud and clear about,
yeah,
that.
I'm going to pull up what the State Energy Office put together this past weekend, actually, about average setbacks that counties have adopted so far. In our ordinance standards, and I'm going to pass this to Lane to speak to, setbacks are meaningful. They need to be there, and they should be complemented with a vegetative buffer so that these things aren't as visible as they could possibly be. I'm looking here. The median number of, the median number that counties so far have selected for setbacks is 100 feet from the property line, 150 feet from residences, and 50 feet of a landscape buffer if there isn't already one installed.
You said that's the median?
Yes, sir. Okay. And he sent me a fancy graph, which I'd be more than happy to share with you all. And it's kind of a heat map of what folks are, what different counties have adopted to date. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, in our ordinance standards, we recommend between 50 and 100. We think a lot can be accomplished within that setback from a property line, while still respecting the property rights of the person who owns that property. Protect the neighbors from view, protect the property rights. I heard Lane at one public hearing, and please recite it if you remember, if you've got a 300-foot setback, every 100 foot on that property line is what, an acre that you take out of?
It depends on the project. So, you know, your acre is 210 by 210, all right? So if you've got a large enough project, which this one was, you know, every 100 feet, you were taking out 1.2 acres of solar panels. It almost made the project impossible to build, okay? And that's where each project, you can set an ordinance of a minimum of this, a minimum of that, maximum of this, you know, whatever. But at the end of the day, you know, like Halifax County, they've got some setbacks are 25 feet from property lines. Some are 50, some are 100. Take the Stanton River, you know, even building on a bluff, people were at the Board of Supervisors and Planning Commission meeting when they went before 2232, the Hallandale project, and they were fussing. Oh, you're going to be able to see it. That section of the river where this solar project is going was on a bluff, 75 feet in elevation above the river. If you could see a solar panel sitting back 300 feet from the river where this thing was sitting, you had to have been using a telescope or a drone. You know, at the end of the day, you set a minimum ordinance, 50 to 150 feet, depending on what it is. You make sure it's a vegetated buffer between roads and your LOD, limits of disturbance, chain link fence that's going around the panels. And I would recommend leaving a natural buffer that's there, whether it's cut over, pine plantation, whatever the case may be, leave the natural one there of 100 to 150 feet. And build your projects, because you can't replicate what Mother Nature built. You can't make it a stick. I don't care how much landscaping you put there. People are still gonna fuss about it for 5 years until your landscaping takes root and matures enough to block the fence. So if you can, everywhere where you can leave natural vegetation, it's great. And I guarantee you, landowners that are beside these projects, they're not going to fuss that much about the property lines or how close it is to the property line, because most of them are going to be out in the country anyway, away from subdivisions and what have you. You know, and if they're not, then you get those setbacks further. You know, but a lot of people in Halifax, Charlotte, Pennsylvania, Henry, you know, Amelia complained some, but most of your adjacent landowners won't complain that much as long as the setback suits them. And it needs to be a reasonable setback, not 1,000, 2,000 feet. That's just unheard of.
Did you say 25 is unreasonable for being short on a setback?
25 feet from a neighboring adjacent property?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Halifax adopted that because the landowners around the project, and it's Piney Creek. It's on Roger Chapel Road. It was just there today. The back corners of the property is 25 feet from the adjacent landowner's property line because they agreed to it. You know, they didn't argue and fuss about it. They said, you know what, you're putting up a chain link fence, I don't have to worry about that neighbor making noise or anything else, and they went with it. Now, as it progressed around in adjacent property owners, it got as far away as 100 feet from adjacent property owners. But two property owners on the Mill Road side, they're 25 feet from the property pins. I cleared the grub and I can see the property pin in the woods.
Before a rural county like Buvanna, where a lot of our property is A1, that is surrounded by a lot of homes and neighbors, should be
developer not only work with the owner of the land who wants to put the solar farm, but even shouldn't they also try to work with those neighbors to try to figure out what that setback should be?
Yes, and that's where your solar community meetings come into play, okay? The solar developers, and y'all set this in your ordinance when you make it, and you don't have to have ordinance in place to go with these. You just have to make sure that every little thing is covered how you want it, the landowners want it, before you approve the project. But the community meetings, they advertise them 2 weeks before they have it, up to a month if that's what you require. But at the end of the day, they'll have two or three community meetings where every single landowner that is adjacent to or in that project will be at. They can get all the information they want. The developer will talk to the landowners and say, okay, well, we're right here beside of you. Know you're adjacent to it. Are you okay with 25 feet, 50 feet, 100 feet, whatever? They can make their own deals and work everything out with that landowner before it ever comes to you.
So do you suggest that before we approve any of these solar facilities, that we have a lot of this in our ordinances? Decommissioning, setbacks, all that stuff?
No. I suggest you have it in your siting agreement and conditional use permit. Your ordinance can come later, because your ordinance can be 10 items or 5,000 items. You just make sure that when they come do the presentation, they describe their project, you do your due diligence and say, okay, I want three community meetings around this project, or five, whatever y'all deem necessary. You want written statements from landowners adjacent to the project, stating that they have been discussed with, what their setbacks that they would like to see. There's always room for compromise with anybody. You will run across one that won't compromise at all, but at the end of the day, you have one mad person versus 50. But everybody normally can come to a happy meeting. And, you know, it might not be 50 feet, it might be 70 feet. You know, but you can do that with your siting agreement and conditional use permit. Every condition that's in that conditional use permit has to be met, whether it's in your ordinance or not. If you've got a particular project, say Kent Store, you're gonna be sitting there building one in Kent Store, all right? Say you've got land right beside of it. Well, you want your property line to be at least 500 feet from the fence. The other one on the other side says, well, we're fine with 150. All right, well, then you can put in your conditional use permit, item number one or 71, whatever the case may be, the LOD, limits of disturbance, along your property will be a minimum of 500 feet. Or if you compromise less, then that's up to you. But that can all go in your conditional use permit. The biggest things that you have to cover in your site agreement and conditional use permit is what you would think you would want in your ordinance. You can go above and beyond. Randolph Solar, when they approved that, that's a 13,000 acre project. 6,000 of it is in wildlife conservation easement, can never be disturbed for the life of the project. It's 25 years with a 5-year extension option to the landowners. It's 3,040 acres of panels. So the other 4,000 is erosion control items. Dominion went so far as to say, okay, for erosion control sediment basins, instead of DEQ's one pond for 50 acres, we want a pond for every 25 acres. So they doubled the sediment basins to control sediment along the Stanton River in Roanoke Creeks to ensure that no sediment could get to those rivers. It all would be filtered. You know, stormwater conveyance channels. You know, you'll see engineers, they want to come in and put 30, 40 degrees of slope in a stormwater conveyance channel. Dominion said no, max is 8%. Grass won't grow on 20%. You know, all this type of stuff can go in your conditional use permit. You do not have to have a 50-page ordinance right now to approve projects.
So one of the concerns with the ordinance is once it's by right, we, at least at the Planning Commission level, we have no review of it.
So I don't.
So, and in raising the concern of, you know, where we want and how many of these we want, another concern is we're taking farmland out of play while this stuff's there. So it comes down to, you know, food manufacturing. Is there anything that's addressing that issue?
So county staff can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think this will ever become a by right use. I think creating an ordinance signals the kinds of projects that you want, but good projects are built working with a developer, working with the neighbors, as Lane mentioned, working with each one of you on a particular project to make it the best possible project on this piece of land possible. The best ordinances that the state has does not necessarily create the best project. So what we always say is judge a project individually on its merits. A lot of Virginia is putting a pine plantation type land into solar projects. And a good way to think about that is taking one crop of a pine tree 30-35 years out of production. Folks are very concerned about farmland. I think a very quick and easy way to get around that is through agrivoltaics, pollinator species, grazing of animals under these panels. It's a dual use. You're creating electricity, you're double dipping in the benefits, as our solar grazer friend would say. Virginia continues to increase its agricultural exports year after year. Unfortunately, but it's just the fact of people making personal decisions, selling land, taking it out of production. Farmland has seen a decrease in acreage over the year, although last year we lost 0 acres of farmland. And I know Lane has probably worked on projects that represent thousands of acres being taken out. So land shifts between different uses, very sensitive to those concerns. The supervisors we work with who are, you know, cattle farmers have big concerns about the larger farm economy. We want to be fair in our criticisms of solar. An acre of a project, an acre in a project can and should be returned to its farming use after that 30-year lifespan. A home or a neighborhood is never going to be decommissioned. If you take up agriculture land to build a home, it is never going to return to that original spot. Homes are permanent. Solar projects are temporary but long-term land uses.
We have 2 minutes left, and y'all have about that time. Do you want to go any extra time, or should we cut off here and decide on what's the next step?
I would suggest we go ahead and cut off and decide next.
Yeah, we need to, because this is just a beginning, I think. And
well,
I think
you.
We need to have another workshop, because I can see there are questions that people want to ask.
Yeah, I think
we
it would
have
be
a
worth,
lot of things
I mean,
we've gotten to.
Worth having a discussion
yeah.
with regards to the comp plan. That
right.
never came up either.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I think that'd be
one quick
yeah.
question for staff. In Savannah, if we put solar on agricultural land, does the zoning change, or does it stay A1?
No, it's
A1.
It remains A1. So it doesn't?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, but what they said was that if you now set your own ordinances and tax accordingly to how you see the results in the future of doing before, so
yeah, most counties are doing that.
Well, thank you, Chair.
Yeah,
right,
so
let's just speak with you.
Yeah, thank you. So we need to have some more
and feel
conversation.
Feel free to reach out
yeah.
to me through
okay.
Eric or
yes.
Schuyler.
Good.
You know, we'd be glad to
thank
come back
so
if you want.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great.
Thank
you.
Thank
you. Okay. You don't have to do it.
Okay.
Thank
motion to
Do we need
to have
some
a motion
planning
to
commission
adjourn?
Needs to make adjourn.
Yes.
I'll make a motion that the Planning Commission adjourn for the evening.
I have a motion by Mr. Goad to adjourn.
A second.
I have a second by Mr. Morgan. All in favor say aye.
If I could hold.
Yes.
So as Moselle was saying, we need to have some discussion of what next steps are. Is the Board of Supervisors going to do that alone? Or?
No, we were going to have another work session.
Yeah.
Is that enough? Is that enough to say to move forward?
I think we should have another work session.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
and in some way decide who the next,
yes,
the next speaker that might have some different,
sure,
perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Mike, you have something?
Yeah, I was, Madam Chair, I was going to agree. I was basically going to say what Chris said. You know, I know Skylar, and I've been talked on the phone with Lane a little bit, and I've known Skylar for a couple months now. And, you know, I know they have some perspectives, mm-hmm, that are probably a little, you know, their job is to, I mean, I know Skylar as well, is to educate people on why these projects could be a good thing. I think it would be important for us to hear about, okay, well, why, what are some of the, you know, negatives that could be, you know, so it would be, yeah, nice to kind of hear that and balance that out and then be able to have a conversation as a group of 10 again and say, okay, now we've heard this and we've heard that, what do we think?
Yeah, we'd like to maybe have more community people come in too to listen.
Right. Does the board or the commission, I mean, is there, because like I said, I'm not aware of anyone that would, as Mr. Gold was saying, kind of bring that different perspective. Does
the
board
or
commission have any
show
thoughts or maybe?
I thought there was another group that couldn't show. Attorney Whitten had.
I mentioned there's a group called Advantage Strategies, yes, that represents 7-8 counties in the south side.
Yes.
And they may be able to provide a perspective, mm-hmm, because they represent those counties at the General Assembly, and they know, and they work on solar issues,
okay,
for 4 or 5 years.
So we need to look for.
And I can bring some suggestions,
sure,
to the table too.
Okay.
Is there any criteria for that? Like, is it? I mean, you obviously want people to have credentials and things like that. Is there any specific?
I think it's up to both bodies. What do they want? I mean, yes. I mean, I think certainly having some good credentials and some type of background, mm-hmm, experience is helpful. But
I
don't know.
I think there would be credible people to come forward.
I would say we're not going to figure out tonight,
no,
who that's going,
right,
to be, and let's,
yeah,
discuss kind of offline,
mm-hmm,
and see what, you know.
Well,
how we come back together.
And the one thing I just want to understand from the board, because again, we do have some solar projects that are starting to come forward. We have one that's coming next month, the Planning Commission in November. I know Mr. Whitten and myself, we've been speaking with one company about siting agreements. So these things are kind of moving forward. So I'm trying to get an idea of how quickly do we want to do these. Do the next work session and
as
kind of
fast
where we
as
go.
We can.
And can we do another one beginning of November?
Yes.
Before the 8th meeting, because our next meeting is on the 8th, and that's when the next solar, I think it's Pine Gate, is coming to us.
Did we have a large agenda on our first meeting for November?
No, not at this point. I know we've got a couple potential presentations. I mean, we could
we do something, let's say at 7
before
o'clock?
Before the 8th.
Five to seven.
Yeah, we could do we got the regular meeting from 5 to whatever, and then we could try and, you know, we could try and make the agenda somewhat short, so then
let's make it 2 hours for this discussion.
Okay.
More time. Yeah. Okay, are we finished? Do you want to carry a motion?
So can you say
I have a motion by
November 1st is
yeah,
what I heard.
Okay.
Trying to get, yeah.
So then when we,
he's going to carry his motion.
Okay. I was just trying to figure out that since it's a 5 o'clock meeting, maybe I missed this part. When do we meet then?
So we would do it after the work session. Would that be after the regular meeting?
Just talked about having a short agenda.
Yeah.
So possibly
yes,
we could be done by 7 o'clock.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
We could have
right,
a work session 7 to 8.
Okay.
Or 7 to 8:30.
All right. I think you can do it now.
I have a motion by Ms. Goode. I have a second by Ms. Morgan. All Planning Commission members, favor say aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. 5-0. We now adjourn. Thank you very
all
much.
Right.
Thank
you
all.
Too.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
you.
Thank
you.
Scratch your part.
Thank you all, baby.
Thank
y'all.
Thank
you.
Thank
all of you were on time, I must say. It's nice to see. I told you he'd be
there. He can't mess up his reputation. That's his. Yeah. All right. Mr. O'Brien.
Madam Chair, I move to the Nevada County Board of Supervisors to enter into closed meeting pursuant to provisions of Section 2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2. Savannah County, I move the closed meeting be adjourned and Savannah County Supervisor, Board of Supervisors convene again in open session. Be resolved, the Board of Supervisors does hereby certify to the best of each member's knowledge, one, only public business matters lawfully exempted from meeting requirements under Section 2-2-3711A of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended, and two, only such public business matters as were identified in the meeting, in the motion, in the motion which the closed meeting was convened, were discussed, or considered in the meeting.
Second.
All right, we have a motion by Mr. Bryant, second by Mr. Sheridan. All in favor? Aye.
No. You gotta do roll call.
Oh, I always forget the roll call. Mr. Fairchild.
Aye, yes.
Mr. Sheridan.
Aye.
Mr. O'Brien.
Aye.
Ms. Ziegler, and Chair votes aye. Okay. So we are now in open session. Do I do the, I have to go into meeting and then, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, now I'd like to call to order our regular Board of Supervisors meeting on October 18, 2023. Our regular meeting at 7 o'clock meeting, a little after 7, but you're pretty good. You will now stand for the Pledge of Allegiance and a moment of silence.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Adoption of the agenda.
Madam Chair, can I add one topic to
yes.
the agenda under new business?
Yes.
And that topic is a resolution authorizing the county administrator to sign necessary documents for deed of gift for real property from Fluvanna Rescue Squad.
All right, thank you. May we have a motion to adopt the agenda?
So moved.
With the added.
Okay,
we have a second?
Second.
No, motion by Mr. Bryant, second by Mrs. Ziegler to adopt the agenda. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? And chair votes aye. County administrator, your report, please.
What's up with them?
I guess, sorry, Madam Chair.
That's okay.
Yeah, just have a few things to report on this evening. So one, early happy birthday for Mr. Sheridan. We're not going to say how old he is, but I know it's coming up.
Well, I tell you what, it's the last time I get to celebrate in the bed. I'll wear it down for
you. Another decade.
69.
Oh, you are? Wow.
Early happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
So this Saturday, October 21st, again, we're having our second coffee and conversation with the county. It's going to be held, as I said, Saturday, October 21st. Again, we've heard that the first one kind of 14 year. This one's going to be kind of for the Lake Monticello area. It's going to be from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. We're going to be having it at the Lake Monticello Volunteer Firehouse, Fire and Rescue facility there in the Maple Room, which is at 10 Slice Road. And again, kind of the same process and kind of procedure that we did before. And again, that's Saturday, October 21st, this Saturday between 10 and 1 p.m. Also, we have a new sign at Pleasant Grove. The love sign is up in the front area of Pleasant Grove Park. So one, this is a silver award project that is just about complete by Eliza Inskeep of Fluvanna Girl Scout Troop 1106. She is a current ninth grader at Fluvanna County High School. So the project started in late April of 2023 and final completion is expected by November. One, the letters are made by 8x8 posts, and some things still to do, as you can see from the pictures, there's some metal galvanized brackets at the bottom. They just have to paint the brackets the same colors as the letters, and there's some little minor landscaping to do. Again, the total cost for this project was a little over $2,200, and it came from the existing Parks and Rec budget. The county had already kind of an approved
Virginia Tourism Authority Love Creation Reimbursement Fund Grant. So the county is getting $1,500 reimbursement from the Virginia Tourism Love Grant. And big thanks to Dean and Sophie Lackey, Christian Bunch, the Inskeep family, and certainly the Parks and Recreation staff for the assistance with getting the love sign area ready and the sign set. So I know Mr. Spitzer was out there doing concrete, him and his folks, and so again, happy to have that, and you know, kind of be something for, you know, tourists to come by and kind of get pictures with, and you know, try and get more Savannah on the map a little bit more.
May I add something to that? The Civil Award, Mrs. Eager and I, we gave the first Silver Awards to girls before the COVID, right? Because we've done it a lot for Eager Scouts, and we did have the opportunity to do it for the girls. So I hope they invite us to, when they do the honors, they were put above in their ears. I'd love to be there.
I know Mr. Spitzer's got a thumbs up on that. He'll put the word out.
Thank you.
Yep. And some other announcements. Again, Saturday, October 28th, the 2023 annual Halloween Festival at Pleasant Grove Park. Again, 6:30 to 8:30. They'll have a semi-scary haunted trail, and then the individuals are signing up for trunk and treat there. So again, that's at Pleasant Grove Park. Saturday, October 28th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. And just some upcoming meetings. Again, we spoke about the coffee and conversation meeting this Saturday, October 21st. And then some upcoming meetings, November 1, and we'll have a regular meeting at 5 p.m., November 15th at 7 p.m., and then December 6th at 5 p.m. And we'll inform the board more about kind of, you know, what we can do as far as getting the work session set up for November 1st after we try and get some outreach to some others. But I'm happy to answer any questions from the board.
All right, any questions? If not, now I'm going to open the public comments number one. If you would like to speak to the board, would you come to the lectern here in front and address the board, give your name and address. Anyone would like to speak to the board, please come forward.
Good evening.
Good evening.
My name is James Kelly. I live at 363 Manor Boulevard in Palmyra, Virginia. And today I'm here as your school board chair. Our school board met 1 week ago today. And we had a rather long and eventful meeting. We had some issues with the Facebook. The sound was bad. And so I do have a summary of the events of that night. It is not without editorial, but you know, you can find it on my personal Facebook. I think most of you have me there, and I'm sure others can help you find it. But one of the things that got lost due to lack of sound and so on and so forth is actually the fact that our board made a motion that carried 4-0 to ask your board kindly to consider using carryover funds in order to offset some of the CIP, the capital improvement plan priorities. I will note that there are a substantial amount of CIP items that are on our list that are big ticket items. And I have gone through and seen each and every one of them myself, because in order to advocate and in order to lead my board, I need to be able to look you in the eyes and say that I've seen this and it's a problem, or help prioritize or rank order these things. And so the motion that we passed 4-0 with one absent is to ask you to use the $518,000-ish that we are returning for carryover funds to help with the renovation of the central elementary bathroom. That happens to be one of the projects where, you know, if you haven't been in the elementary schools recently, especially in the boys' bathroom, it is really quite difficult to get the smell of urine out from underneath the tiles. We all know that boys maybe have worse aim than little girls, and the tiles are quite old, and in fact this is part of the old building and may very well be original fixtures in and of itself. The $500,000 is actually enough to offset the renovation of 4 bathrooms in the old part of the building, and that would be 2 boys and 2 girls bathrooms. I would invite any of you at any time, if you're interested in going and exploring any of the CIP items, I'd be more than happy to make myself available for that. That said, above and beyond just the central elementary bathrooms, there are a number of big ticket items on the CIP this year, and I'm astounded by how we got to this place in some ways, and some things just age and need repair. Some things we've put Band-Aids on historically, and to be honest, the Band-Aids just aren't holding any longer. And so in particular, we have three things on the CIP this year that are big ticket and that I've seen and that I think are serious and of note. The one that really shocked me is just the disrepair that's going on at the middle school track. And I know that the former chair and others have been saying this for years, that the track is really dilapidated. But until I went back over there and took another look, I think it was about a month ago, I didn't realize just how poor that middle school track is. I don't know why. To be honest, it's a safety issue. I don't know why we continue to use it at all, because I feel like if I just went for a leisurely walk, I might trip and hurt myself. In addition to that, we've been putting, and you know, if you go to middle school track, you'll just see layer after layer after layer of where they've resurfaced it. And they're just like, the layers are falling apart and spreading, and it's honestly unsafe and needs to be renovated. The high school track is also honestly been patched and band-aided, and it is still super rough. There, especially on what do they call it? Lane one, the inside lane. I wouldn't run on that, let alone someone who is, you know, a track athlete or someone who aspires to compete at the collegiate level. And then finally, our turf at the high school has, in fact, kind of run out its life, and we can continue to band-aid it as well. And there are some order of operations, you know, the turf being done before the track is important, et cetera, but there are some substantial items on the CIP, and we can continue to put band-aids on and do our best, but there are some real fundamental problems with each of these. And so I ask that you'll consider using some carryover funds to lighten the CIP load, and that you'll think seriously about investing in these things for our schools. I'm greatly appreciative of what you've done for us historically, and thank you so much.
Thank you. I apologize. I did not mention, I did mention that if you are here to speak, we have three public hearings. So if you're here to speak on the public hearings, that'll come up later. But right now, if anyone else would like to come to the mic to speak to the board about anything other than the public hearings, please come, give your name, address, and you have 5 minutes. Anyone? If not, I will close the first public comments. Okay. All right, we have our first public hearing, and I would like to read instructions. The general rules of order. It shall be the duty of the chairman to maintain order and decorum at meetings. I'm sorry, wrong place. Purpose. The purpose of a public hearing is to receive testimony from the public on certain resolution, ordinances, or amendments prior to taking action. A hearing is not a dialogue or debate. Its express purpose is to receive additional facts, comments, and opinions on subject items. Speakers. Speakers shall approach the lectern so they may be visible and audible to the board. Each speaker shall clearly state his or her name and address. All comments shall be directed to the board. All questions shall be directed to the chairperson. Members of the board are not expected to respond to questions, and respond to questions shall be made at the chairman's discretion. Speakers are encouraged to contact staff regarding unresolved concerns or to receive additional information. speakers with questions are encouraged to call county staff prior to the public hearing. Speakers shall be brief and avoid repetition of previously presented comments. Action. At the conclusion of the public hearing on each item, the chairman will close the public hearing. The board will proceed with its deliberation and will act on a formally postponed action on such item prior to proceeding to other agenda items. Further public comment after the public hearing has been closed generally will not be permitted. So the first public hearing that we have is the public hearing to quit claim property to the Fluvanna County Historical Society. And this will be presented by our attorney, Mr. Whitten.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. I'm going to give a brief history of the property. And so the property was conveyed by deed from David Ross in 1805 to five trustees of the town of Columbia. And the property includes four lots, one identified in the plat of the town of Columbia, approximately 1 acre in total, and it was utilized as a public burial ground known as the Free Hill Cemetery. So the charter of the town of Columbia was revoked in 2016, and all of the public property of the town reverted by operation of law to the county, which would include any interest in the property. However, the county has been unable to ascertain any interest in the property in fee simple, and actually the Commissioner of Revenue does identify the property as being owned by the Columbia Baptist Church. But just to make sure there's clear title, because eventually the Historical Society once this property is quit claim to the Historical Society, they then want to quit claim it to the Columbia Baptist Church. So we want to make sure there's clear title, so that's why we're doing this quit claim, or requesting this quit claim. So Virginia Code Section 15.2-953 does authorize the donation of all rights, titles, and interests in the property to the Historical Society. This would include any interest and fee the county may have with respect to the platted but undeveloped streets. It would not abandon, release, or affect any right of the public to traverse the streets, any public right-of-ways. And it would be a condition of the donation of the property that it would be used in a manner consistent with the historical uses of the property. Which will include the preservation of the property and preserving the historic value of the property. So Virginia Code 15.2-1800 does require a public hearing before the county may dispose of real property. A quit claim deed would be without any special warranty or general warranty that the county owns a fee simple interest in the property. Is there any questions? Or there also is a member? Director of the Historical Society. Sorry, I don't know your exact title.
Ms. Johnson, would you like?
Yes, ma'am.
My name is Patricia Johnson. I live at 317 Shannon Hill Road in Columbia. I'm Mr. Sheridan. He's my representative. And I am the director of the Fluvanna Historical Society. Thank you, Mr. Whitten. I want to start by thanking the county. It has been a pleasure to work with all of you, to talk with you about this historic property, and it really is historic. I also want to give you a couple of pieces of information, and that is the impetus ultimately for getting this property into the church's hands is that so that we can then help them apply for grant funding that will fund further research and preservation of the property. But for most of those grants, the property needed to be in the church's name. So that would be the impetus for this. I'll give you another update. We have had ground penetrating radar conducted on two test sites in the cemetery. Extrapolating from that data, assuming that the density of graves is consistent throughout the entire area, it is possible that there are more than 500 burials on that site. It is a significant historic cemetery, and we are grateful to be able to act as just an assistant to the good people of Columbia Baptist Church who want to honor and respect their ancestors who lie at rest there. Does anyone have any questions I can answer for you?
Any questions for Ms. Johnson?
I forgot one thing. I do want to thank you, Mr. Sheridan and Mitchell Pace from the high school. brought the high school football team out to help clear the scrub growth from that cemetery, and that was a huge gift, and we appreciate it very much. There are also some members of the church here if they wish to speak.
Yeah, I have family there. Yeah.
Thank you.
Anyone?
I have one question.
Yes.
When you did the ground penetrating radar, did you get to check what I asked you to check?
Mm-hmm. We believe that that is empty.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions, Mrs. Johnson? Okay. If not, I will open the public comment. Anyone who would like to speak about this particular project, would you please come forward? Okay, Mr. Morgan. Mr. Rapp.
Good evening. Good evening. Again. Mm-hmm. Loretta Johnson Morgan, 18 Lake Grove, Troy, Virginia. I am a member of Columbia Baptist Church, and I just want to say thank you to the board, our attorneys, the county, for working on this project with us. We've been trying to clean up the cemetery and get it in good condition, and we hope that all of this goes through properly and both quick claim deeds will go through properly and give us back the ownership. But I just want to say thank you on behalf of the members.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, anyone else? If not, I will close the public comments at this time and bring back to the board. Anyone like to make any talk about this project? Any questions?
Tony told me not to ask questions.
Yeah.
9:30.
Yeah.
9:30. I know y'all.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure going down there and working with
you. Yeah.
It truly has.
Right.
And it has been great fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's great.
We were looking for it.
Yeah.
Except for when Miss Morgan was picking one.
Yeah, and I understand they're gonna fence it in and a plaque to recognize those bodies that you could not identify, that you know you have 100 and something.
I'll tell one quick story.
Yeah.
You never know how this will be affect you. Mm-hmm. My sister worked in Richmond at a elementary school right across the road from Deep Run High School. And her librarian that she was the assistant for, African American lady. And unbeknownst to me, she found out about us going over to the football team, and the next thing you know, she has family members that are buried in that cemetery. And has been up there a couple times trying to get in touch with Ms. Johnson.
Right.
You never know who it's going to touch.
That's true. Yeah.
That's something we got to teach these kids. It's not about what I can do for my own little piece of the world, it's what I can do for them.
Yes. Yes. My father was a minister of Columbia Church for a while. And my first cousin right now is looking for a plaque to put where her little brother that you all cleared away, and now we know where he is. So it's very touching and very important. Thank you. Okay. Our next public hearing.
Motion.
Motion. That's right, y'all. Keep me straight.
I move that the Board of Supervisors approve a resolution to quitclaim property identified as tax map numbers 54A-1, lots 37, 38, 53, and 54 to the Savannah County Historical Society.
Okay. Wait a second. We have a motion by Mr. Fairchild and a second by Mr. Sherry. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, I don't think we have anybody to say nay, but I have to ask anyone do not approve. Chair votes aye, so we are 5-0. Thank you all. Okay, the next public hearing is revenue share of $1,400 per megawatt for solar energy projects and energy storage system. Our attorney, Mr. Whitten.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. Currently, there's not a revenue share ordinance in the county on solar energy projects or battery energy projects, battery storage projects. Virginia Code Section 58.1-2636 does authorize localities to assess a revenue share of up to $1,400 per megawatt as measured in AC generation capacity based on submissions by the facility owner to the interconnecting utility on any solar energy project. Or up to $1,400 per megawatt for energy storage systems, which are battery storage projects. The proposal is to enact County Code Sections 20-12-1 through 20-12-3, and the ordinance would authorize a revenue share of $1,400 per megawatt for solar energy projects and energy storage systems, and this would be on an annual basis, the payment to be made. Right now, energy storage systems are not a use in our zoning ordinance, but that text amendment will be brought in the near future, hopefully by the end of the year, to the Planning Commission. And so I went ahead and proposed adding this now to the ordinance rather than coming back at the beginning of the year to add this language regarding battery storage systems. There are certain exemptions. It doesn't apply to solar facilities, which are described in four different Virginia code sections, and those are customer generator facilities and small agricultural generator facilities. And it also does not apply to any solar projects for which an application was filed with the county and approved prior to January 1st of 2021. Were there any questions about how the revenue share ordinance would work? This would be in place of the machinery and tools taxation, as we discussed at a work session at the prior meeting.
And just remember, by the county having this enacted, it doesn't mean that the county would, it doesn't give any like clear path the county needs to approve solar projects. It just recognizes what is the taxation model for those projects if they are approved.
Okay, any other questions?
Yes, the 10% increase over, was it 5 years?
Yes, every 5 years there's a 10% increase.
That's
in amount.
2% a year, that's not very much.
That's set by state code.
That's as much as the state allows.
Correct. And so maybe at some point the state, we can talk to our legislators about raising that. But for now.
And could we change it after that?
Yes, we could come back. If we were able to have, if we had authority from the state for a higher initial amount or a higher amount every 5 years, that's something we could talk to our legislators about. And David Blount, who weighs out, I think he's going to our next meeting. So we could ask that question when the state may revisit that number.
This tax is just for the energy. It's not for the land. The person who owns it and leases it to the energy company would still pay land tax on it, right?
There's still real estate taxes. Right. And they would still pay the rollback taxes when it goes out of land use as well.
Okay. Okay, so now we'll open up the public hearing. Anyone would like to speak to this particular project, which will come to the lectern and give you name and address, and you have 5 minutes. Seeing no one, I will close public hearing, bring back to the board, or do we have anything else we need to discuss? Okay. If not, we will go to public.
Motion.
Motion.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
I move the Board of Supervisors amend the County Code to enact 20-12-1, 20-12-2, 20-12-3 to authorize a revenue share of $1,400 per megawatt for solar energy projects and energy storage systems.
Okay, do we have a second?
Second.
All right, the motion was made by Mr. Fairchild, second by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye. And then our last public hearing is for an ordinance to authorize the collection of a 5% transient occupancy tax. Mr. Wickens.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. Currently, there's not a transient occupancy tax in the county. This is a tax authorized under Virginia Code Section 58.1-3819. And this is for hotels, motels, boarding houses, travel campgrounds, any other facilities that offer guest rooms rented out for occupancy for fewer than 30 days. So this would also be for Airbnbs or VRBO short-term rentals. Or, for instance, the Briary Creek Campground, which is coming through the Planning Commission. The proposal is to enact the County Code Sections 20-11-1 through 20-11-10. So the tax will be imposed on the total price paid by the customer for the use of the space. So that would be, like if you book on Airbnb, you have to pay a cleaning fee, you have to pay a fee to Airbnb, and then the base rental fee, for example. Same as a hotel, you book through Expedia. You know, there's separate fees that you pay. says the 5% tax is based on the total price code. So the accommodation is intermediary, which would be VRBO or Expedia. They would collect the tax and remit it to the treasurer. Or if the person is just renting out their house on a short-term basis individually, they would also collect the tax. After 30 days, the tax is no longer collected, so it doesn't affect month-to-month rentals. The person collecting the tax would send a report to the Commissioner of Revenue showing the total room charges collected and the total tax, and the accommodations intermediary must submit the property addresses and gross receipts for all properties located in the county that they handle on a monthly basis. So accommodations intermediary, as I spoke, that's VRBO, Airbnb, Expedia, Hotels.com, any of those companies that basically facilitate the sale of the accommodation and collect the fee. The accommodations provider is anyone who furnishes accommodations to the public for compensation, and so that they have an individual website where they're renting on a daily or weekly basis. So the proposal is a 5% transient occupancy tax. Under the state code, any excess from the rate over 2% but not exceed 5% needs to be used for tourism and travel and marketing of tourism and initiatives, basically working with the Chamber of Commerce and the Economic Development Authority director, and basically bringing travelers to the locality. So I presented the rates for other localities. Albemarle County right now is 8%. Louisa is currently 2%, but there's an article in the paper, I believe last week, that they plan to advertise a 5% rate. And they actually mentioned Flavanna in the article that we were advertising a 5% rate. Buckingham is currently 2%, and Richland is currently 2%. Were there any, under state code, there's not a maximum rate. That changed a couple of years ago. For instance, at Chesterfield, it's 10%. I think there's a chart online that shows the rates across the whole state. I think that was the highest I saw was 10%. Are there any questions?
If not, I will open the public hearing. Anyone would like to speak to this particular public, this presentation, please come to the lectern and give your name and address. And you have 5 minutes.
Madam Chairman, my name is Paul Beyer. I reside in Fort Union, James and Madison Highway address. I was looking at this proposed ordinance tax collection issue. It came to mind as the advertisement in the newspaper, and it caused a little bit of shock in a way, because it's been about 6 weeks since my son and I started to renovate a farmhouse, thinking in terms of Airbnb. And obviously that can put a damper on someone's thinking when you see something like this come up. I think that as I read the ordinance, it is so broad. I realize that the reason it came up was because of the development up on 640 or Rolling Road. But we have talked on the family farm, which I inherited, of getting involved with Hip Camp, for instance, where people can come in and camp on your property. The farm fronts on the James River, maybe spend a week down along the banks of the James River, that kind of stuff. And my concern is that the way the ordinance reads, such activities would be subject to the taxation, or renting the farmhouse as an Airbnb would be subject to the taxation. Or, for instance, Camp Friendship would be subject to the taxation. They're less than 30-day rentals. And I'm concerned that the ordinance is so overly broad that it's going to cause hardship to property owners. It's going to cause you guys a heck of a time trying to collect it. And I think you need to do some research on it and narrow it down to something that is manageable and something that won't hurt the small people involved in this. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Fire. Anyone else would like to speak to the board? If not, I will close the public hearing and turn it back for deliberation with the board members.
Interesting point as to whether camp function would be taxed under this ordinance, since, you know, a camp for day campers to be.
So basically, it's for overnight accommodations. So it had to be for overnight accommodations for less than 30 days. So it would.
But they had overnight.
But it's not a. It's a definition, real quick. But
I got you.
Thank you, because it's juveniles coming in there to a camp situation.
Yeah.
There's not a tax.
Your mic's
kind of far. I'm sorry.
So basically, the tax is on the person running the facility. It's not on the actual property owner. So it's basically a pass-through tax. It's collected. So right now, if you have an Airbnb in the county, if you try to rent that online, it doesn't show that that tax is there. If you go to other counties that have a transient tax, that's added to the cost of that Airbnb. That 5% is an additional fee. So it doesn't come from the property owner. It actually is additional pass-through tax from the person renting the facility. But the accommodations definition would not include, you know, overnight camp, like a church camp or camp friendship. That's not the intent of the ordinance. And as far as the language, actually the Commissioner of Revenues around the state had put together a model ordinance last year. I believe it started in Northern Virginia. And because the Airbnbs and Expedia's, VRBA's requested more a uniform ordinance, because all the ordinances across the state were so different. And so basically that's why the state started posting the rates across the state for every locality and asked all the different localities to have more uniform ordinance. So that language that's in the ordinance, it did come from that model ordinance. All the definitions and all the enforcement mechanisms. And so the state code did change a couple years ago where the Airbnbs do have to provide the addresses of all the properties. Before that, it was kind of up to the Commissioner of Revenue to find the properties or up to the person who owned it to self-report. So now Airbnb actually has to provide the addresses of every property in the county that they actually provide the services for, rental services for.
And just remember, this is kind of part of a bigger discussion that we had about there's Airbnbs technically by the county ordinance, which we're bringing forward too as a short-term rental ordinance. Technically, you're only allowed, unless you get an SUP or something, you're only technically allowed to rent up to 25% of your home and your home occupation. So there was a lot of Airbnbs that were not to the county's current code that were legal by that, as you go through Airbnb. So one, this was a way to collect a tax for those Airbnbs that are one out there right now. But the next piece of this is looking at the short-term rental ordinance, which we're bringing back to the board too to open it up more. Because again, you either have an SUP or you can only rent 25% of your property right now. You couldn't rent your whole entire residence under what we currently have now.
I see Mr. Byers standing. I'm sure he wants to come forward and say something. Will you allow him to do that?
Yeah.
Board, will you allow him? Mr. Byers, did you want to come and respond?
What I was referring to was the definition that says lodging facility includes any public or private hotel in apartment, hotel, hostelry, tourist camp, tourist cabin, tourist home or house, camping grounds, club, motel, rooming house, any place that offers short-term lodging. So the definition written here, it definitely the concerns that I've talked about are part of the definition that's included here. I just think of all kinds of ramifications. Living in Fork Union, there are people that put guests up when the Academy has a big event, such as last weekend, and they take money for that. That is short-term housing. You know, how's that fit into this? Are you going to make criminals out of those people? Are they going to have to file a monthly statement? You know, I just think that there are so many ifs, ands, and buts associated with this thing that you need to do more work on it.
Thank you, Mr. Spock. All right, we'll come back to the board.
So the Commissioner of Revenue doesn't currently have any intentions of collecting these revenues under self-reporting. Is that correct? Or is
well, right now they can't. They can't collect the tax because we don't have the ordinance.
Right, but he doesn't have any discussions with his office.
O'Brien, get closer to your mic, please. So, you know, at my age, we don't hear very well, being with the mic.
In discussions with his office, has there been any conversations regarding collecting these taxes other than through the providers, such as Airbnb or not?
So, I mean, the majority of the providers, you know, would be your accommodations intermediaries. Now, at HIP campgrounds, that's managed, from what I've seen, by a website similar to the accommodations intermediary. Usually it's not the person themselves. They have a website that manages all over the United States where you can rent HIP campgrounds. So HIP camping, yeah, that would be, you would be collecting a transient tax there as well. Now, as far as the example from Fork Union, if someone's just individually renting out their house for a week or two, then yeah, they would have, I know at the Super Bowl, the Rihanna concert, I read the guy who rented her the house made $500,000 a week. I think he rented it for 2 weeks. So yeah, he would have to pay a transient tax. If there was a transient tax in Arizona in that county, he'd have to pay whatever it is.
It would be a self.
But that would be self-reporting. Because if it's not on a website anywhere, the Commissioner of Revenue would have no idea that that was going on in Fort Kenyon, unless they're self-reporting, because they're not advertising the business. So it really would just be in accordance with the ordinance. Now, there's no, you know, you go to the penalty section as far as criminal penalties. Well, I don't believe.
If we talk about what Mr. Byers said, he's going to have a cottage, and people will stay there, and they'll be able to go down and fish. They can camp. I don't know if he's talking about recreational camping.
If it's done on VRBO or Airbnb, that would be one that would be a pass-through tax. To me, I'm sitting here to myself thinking about this. Mm-hmm. If I go to McDonald's and buy a cheeseburger and a drink, I pay either 4 or 5% in a meals tax. Mm-hmm. That is just added on to my bill. And okay. I mean, 4% of $200.
So the owner, if I'm renting a cottage out, then I add the tax to the person who's renting the property, and then I turn it in.
Correct. Either the owner does, or if you have an intermediary like an Airbnb, they're the ones that automatically calculate that and remit that payment.
Monthly reporting or annual?
Monthly
report. To the meals tax, I've said before, comparing to say a meals tax. I mean, every community has its own dynamics. So in Flavanna, I likely would not vote for a meals tax because the mass of the people eating meals in Flavanna are Flucos. So it's just a tax that we can tax it anyway, you know, real estate, personal property, or whatever. It's just an additional tax on most of the people. If we were in a very touristy area, the meals tax would be having a lot of people come, they would get money off of it. To me, this tax is taxing people that aren't from here. And unless I see something different, the number one type of revenue for a community to have is tourism, because you get to tax them, make money off of them, then they go away.
I.E. 4.
What's that?
I.E. 4.
Yeah. But at the same time, I don't hear that necessarily there's a concern about having the tax at all, but maybe whether there's implications that maybe we have not thought about.
Yeah. I think it would be imprudent to not follow the guidelines that were set by the commissioners. Basically, the commissioner of revenues that got together and said this is what should be, an effort to simplify. I think the question becomes, there are a lot of taxes that are self-reporting. How many computers do you have in your office? Are you reporting all of those? Are they being taxed? So
speak into the mic so we can hear.
There are a lot of taxes that are self-reporting. For example, personal property. Personal property is a self-reporting tax. How about now? There are a lot of taxes that are self-reporting. For example, you're supposed to report all of your personal property. I suspect that some people forget to add a computer or a chair or a desk. So while I'm not encouraging that behavior, I don't think that, as Mr. Witten is about to state, whatever the penalties are such that a law-abiding taxpayer would have to worry about too much. And to Mr. Fairchild's point, this is collecting revenues that are passed through revenues. The majority of these revenues would come through platforms such as Airbnb, VRBO, and CAMPIP, as mentioned there.
Give me my microphone.
We're thinking now. As far as the meals tax go, you're right. Most people that eat here are from Clevet. But for those events that we host on the weekends at Pleasant Grove and Route 15 is a major thoroughfare, so a lot of people stop and eat from Buckingham, Goose. And I'm not trying to pick on our neighbors, but when we drive through there, we leave money there. When they drive through here, and I'll rest my case.
So real on the penalties section, which is 20-11-10, that specifically says any person convicted of willful failure or refusal to file. So it has to be willful. It can't just be inadvertent. Basically, you'd have to prove that the person willfully evaded collecting the tax, or they collected it and failed to turn it over to the county. So if it's inadvertent, there's not going to be any criminal penalties for that. So it's more just educating the people that rent their houses out in Fort Ginion. You just would add a 5% tax to the $100 a night you charge. And if you rent, you go to a hotel in most localities, other localities are charging, like, so people are familiar with that add-on tax.
All right, now, do we think we're at a point that we can make a motion? Are we?
I move that the Board of Supervisors amend the county.
See if anybody else.
Yeah, because if Mr. Byers and anyone else have some other concerns, they can come and talk about the audit. Make a, explain it fully, or make his situation a reality and really show what's. I'm looking at him. I don't know whether he's satisfied.
Yeah, I mean, the Commissioner of Revenue, I'm not sure who in his office would be handling this, but I'm sure he'd be willing to talk to. She had an hour conversation with Mr. Sheridan today, other Mr. Sheridan, about different issues. But I'm sure he's willing to talk to the property owner about, how the process would work.
Right.
And because it is a new process for his office and for the county. Sure. I mean, even though it's a uniform ordinance across the state, it would be a new process for his office, so he wouldn't have to designate someone in his office. He would be answering the questions, and I would say, I could answer any questions as well.
All right.
This has come up before, years ago, when we talked about a tax on motels. At that time, we had so few, it didn't go anywhere. So, but I think now that we have B&Bs and renting out your home is different than the traditional motel. So I just thought I'd let you hear that.
Okay.
And for the clarification of the public, the Briarly project is a 350-unit glamping operation which is a shared between Fluvanna County and Albemarle County. And so unless we pass this ordinance, we can't participate in that tax revenue collection that Albemarle County will be taking. So that's also a part of it. So that's why we're focused on this ordinance now.
And we can have as many as 50 cabins.
And hopefully very soon we'll have a hotel or two.
And that's if we pass it.
If we pass it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, if, yeah. Any other comments?
I'm comfortable that the concerns expressed at this time won't be, aren't a big enough concern not to vote for tonight. However, I also, if you all think there's more discussion and so on, and some things that can be learned still, I don't mind.
You can come back.
If we defer it either, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Either way. Yeah. Is there any concern you all have with deferring it? Is there anything that...
I mean, we could ask Mr. Sheridan if he wanted to come to the board and answer any questions.
I think it would be...
Other Mr. Sheridan.
Yeah.
I'll try to answer.
The commissioner and then Mel Sheridan could always come to the board and answer any questions.
It seems to me that this is a uniform code being recommended. That either we're going to pass it or we're not going to pass it, and I would suggest that we make the motion and just go from there, because it wouldn't make sense to have a separate code that's already been approved by the commissioners of revenues to address some specific need that I think is probably not realistic in the long term here. So I'd like to make the motion, whether I can second it or not.
Go ahead and make the motion, then we a second, then I'll ask for additional discussion because I see.
I move that the Board of Supervisors amend the county code and enacts 20-11-1 through 20-11-10 to authorize the collection of 5% transient occupancy tax.
Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
Okay, we have a second now. Is there further discussion before I call for the vote? Okay, then I'll call for the vote. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? Then vote. Then chair votes aye, so it's passed. So we will do all the things that we said we were going to do. We need to talk about it further, make more clarification. We have citizens that don't quite understand.
All right.
Okay. All right. Action matters. Constitutional officer pay policy. Mr. Whitten.
I'll take this one. So again, we talked about this a little bit prior to January 18, 2017. The county did not have a policy to address starting salaries. Again, at that point, newly elected constitutional officers received the previous pay of the incumbent. The Board of Supervisors adopted Personnel Policy 2.8.6 for constitutional officer pay on January 18, 2017. And so it was discussed to bring it back. And so really, you know, we've had some back and forth with the board. And so really at the last board meeting or the meeting before, it was discussed that we needed to make, there was no indication of wanting to make changes to A under starting salary, but we needed to put some clarifying language under B after me and Mr. Whitten kind of read through and kind of determined what the intent of the board was. The language in red is what the new language is. And again, it just basically says for interim appointments, again, the language in black that's existing says a salary for an appointed interim constitutional officer will be the minimum amount that must be paid to the constitutional officer by the local government as established by General Assembly. And then the new language, the addition is, if the appointed interim constitutional officer is a current employee or their salary is above the minimum amount as established by the General Assembly and reimbursed by the state's Corporation Commission Compensation Board, the current salary of that employee will be the starting salary. And we kind of added the same language that we did for starting salaries per state code. 15.2-1605.1. However, the Board of Supervisors may approve a higher starting salary, and the Board may consider education experience, special skills, certifications, and proficiency in related former roles when determining the higher starting salary. So that's kind of the new addition to the policy. Like I said, have to answer any questions that the Board has.
Any questions? I hear no questions, so we have a motion.
I move that the Board of Supervisors approve the amendment to section 2.8.6 of the personnel policies regarding a salary for an appointed interim constitutional officer.
Okay. I hear a second.
Second.
Motion was made by Mr. Fairchild and second by Mr. Wyatt. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye. Appointments. We have an appointment to the MACA. Mr. Baker served a short term, and I think he attended two meetings. I talked to him the other day just to see how it was going. So he has consented to continue.
Okay.
All right, so we need a motion.
I move the Board of Supervisors approve the following Board Commission or Committee appointment. Monticello Area Community Action Agency, Blue Mountain Citizen Representative Austin Baker, for a term beginning 11-1-2023 and ending 10-31-2025.
Second.
A motion by Mr. Sheridan and second by Mr. Fairchild. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye. Okay. Presentations, none. And next consent agenda. My goodness, I need to read all these. Anyone
want
to pull any of these?
Madam Chair, yes. I got one I just wanted to bring. Ms. Snow brought something to my attention that she needed to make an update to one of the pay rate classification charts. The one that's linked up right here, the one that was in the package for the law enforcement, there was a pay band 107 for the law enforcement one that in what went in the package. It was an incorrect, it was a blank pay band that didn't have a position in it, and it was incorrect. So what we basically did is remove the pay that was in there and just moved all of kind of the pay bands up.
That's H.
So,
is that H? No, that's not H. Is it in the consent?
It was in the consent. It's a, yes, it is H.
H says social services women. Okay.
No.
All
right. Yeah, it was H. The one on the screen here is the correct one. Again, dollar amounts didn't change for any of the pay. Dollar amounts didn't change with the positions. We just had to adjust what pay band those positions fell in because there was one pay band, 107, that was incorrect.
Oh, okay.
So this was correct. So I would just ask if the board's going to make the motion for H as amended. This is the item.
Okay. Any other items need to be pulled? All right, consent agendas, minutes of October 4th meeting, memorandum of understanding to join Jefferson Area Drug Enforcement Task Force, and then the one we just amended, fiscal year 24 pay rates and classification, accounts payable report for September, J, approval of open space agreement for Water D. Brown, and K, approval of open space agreement for Mr. Benjamin Brian Chung and Amanda B. N. Chung. Approval of open space agreement for Holly Reaney Dobson and Jensen Michael Dobson. M, approval of open space agreement for Robert A. Gurnell Jr. Approval of open space agreement for Edward Hudson and Brenda Hudson. Approval of open space agreement for Jeffrey Lynn Johnson II. Approval of open space agreement for Ginger Smith Johnson. Approval of open space agreement for Travis Rittenhouse and Stacy Rittenhouse. R, approval of open space agreement for Troy A. Wright and Don M. Wright. S, fiscal year 24 FCPS grant supplementary appropriation. T, FC24 FCPS, and that's public schools, grant supplemental appropriation. U, fiscal year 23 FCPS and E-Rate supplement approval. And some of those for the school is made by Brenda Gilliam. Those for open space was made by our Commissioner of Revenue, Andrew M. Sheridan Jr.
And didn't you want to add B, a resolution?
No, that's me.
And we have approval for the consent agenda.
So may.
Second. All right. We have made approval for the agenda by Mr. Sheridan, consent agenda by Mr. Sheridan, second by Mr. O'Brien. And next, we have all in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye. Mr. Sheridan, three votes.
I'm just tired. Unfinished business.
I have to keep y'all on your toes.
Yes, ma'am. You made sure I was awake.
You want to read the resolution?
Doesn't matter to me. Go ahead. If you want me to.
Yeah, please.
I don't.
Here you go. Would you pass it down to him?
Alrighty, folks.
We have a resolution for the board.
We're on new business or unfinished business?
We're on new business. We didn't have any.
Yeah. I didn't bring anything up. I wasn't sure if the board had any unfinished business.
Yeah. I do have something I want to say, but I don't know what all of you were told. But I just want to say, in the time since our last board meeting, there's been some stuff said on social media and so on about us turning off the mic feature.
Charlottesville is really getting a real.
Yeah, Charlottesville just did the same thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether we, at a point where we can't stop men's crotches from being thrown up on the screen and a bunch of sexual noises and all the words that come with that up on the screen, or something that didn't even exist in Fluvanna until 2020 for COVID. That has almost nobody who calls in and uses that feature, but it's the portal that gets them to do that and have children, everybody watching here and at home. The last time it happened, it happened with a child in this audience. And so, and in between the two times, it wasn't a quick and easy thought on our side. It was actually published in the paper. The paper said that it happened. So by the time we voted on it, there had been some time to have some thought about it. And I certainly would not ever vote to have in a public venue on our website, on anything associated on if you pull up the video on YouTube or whatever, I am not going to choose to have porn as the better option for something that is hardly ever used until we just figure out how to fix it. Clearly, Charlottesville has come to the same conclusion.
They have, and they said that Lloyd Snooker said, we have only one obligation. We don't have an obligation that we put it on Zoom or whatever.
And if people, until we figure this out, the average person who does have this concern about being able to stand and present their thoughts in public comment can come here and do public comment.
Send us an email. Send a letter.
Yeah.
Send us an email that we can. We're not trying to deprive anyone of their civic rights. Mm-hmm. All we're trying to do is keep this a place where decorum rules.
Or call your supervisor. If you're not a computer person or you're not write a letter. You know, Ms. Eagle's come in here many times where a citizen has called her.
Is there any reason in the Zoom call that if somebody wanted to ask a question, they couldn't put that in the chat message and have?
No, because they're not accessing Zoom anymore. They don't have access. The only way that they can view the meeting is through the YouTube Live.
YouTube Live.
Yes.
But if they come onto YouTube Live, I bet you they could email one of us if they had a question or comment. Or if we could have some place where they could send an email. Thank you.
And if staff is just checking for that, they can read the question.
I was going to say, we'll send it to Ms. Harris and Ms. Solis if possible. I'm not trying to volunteer you with more jobs.
There's some localities that require, for comments to be taken as part of the board meeting. Again, there's some aspect of, some advance notice too.
one, I don't have my email up during the board meeting because I've got a lot of other things on there. So, I mean, there are some localities that even if there's communication that's related to the board, it has to be submitted in advance by a certain period of time, too. I think the schools, Louisiana County Public Schools, they either had something like that or they do, that something has to be submitted by a certain time for it to be considered. So, I mean, but yeah, people can, you know, people always email questions or concerns, but whether it's part of the meeting, that's a different thing.
Can you also, it was brought up that it wasn't on the agenda to vote on it. Can you explain, one of you, how it ended up that, how come we still can, since it wasn't on the agenda for the board to vote on whether we would turn, you know, we all just basically said yes, turn that.
I mean, we never had a policy for it. It was just something we were allowing, and it was something
service that we offered.
It was a service that we offered, and it kind of originated from COVID. I mean, that was the origination.
It's not required by the state code. It's not required by the Freedom of Information Act offers them. So because of the issues we were having, now in the notices, for instance, the Planning Commission notice we're doing for the next meeting, we put in the notice that we're no longer offering a Zoom online comment as a platform. So that's in the public notice for the next Planning Commission meeting. So Planning Commission meeting last week we did, that was the last meeting where we offered Zoom.
But just to be clear, there's nothing that points to that it needed to be on the agenda that we'd be voting on or discussing it. It came up, and we made a decision. Yes.
Here's a great example. I literally just got a text message from one of my constituents. In fact, it's my neighbor. This is the way he attends our meetings. He always listens to our meetings. He just asked if we could possibly find a way that they can ask a question. Just because, like with him, he stays in Kent's door so he can run fire drills. Or so few. Just if we can figure something out.
I'd say let's not belabor it tonight. Let's see what other options you can come up with.
And see whether other places are following suit. Are they doing anything different?
But you're right. I know there's a lot of the other places that haven't allowed it for
It's disheartening to see how quick people were being. Yeah. Like we were trying to deprive them of something.
Somebody said they were emailed that they were appalled. How appalled can you be, even if you disagree with us, that we stop porn from showing up on our video? How appalling. That's so dramatic. And it's just, that's what provoked me.
I'm surprised social media is so dramatic.
Yeah.
All right. Now we finish.
Got another message. I have no idea who this one's from. We do have a meeting moderator, and she was doing her best, but when things are, more than one thing is popping up, you can't keep up.
Yeah. The settings were typed in and changed, and no one could unmute themselves, no one could screen share, and they were able to overcome those settings and unmute themselves and screen share without Ms. Harris able to stop.
Yeah.
So until Zoom can tighten up their security, we really can't use it as a platform.
Okay, so are we ready for the resolution?
Okay, and what we're referring to, folks, is we have a resolution. Resolution number,
Ms. Solis, can you give us what's the next resolution number, please? And you know, we can go back and do it in that fact, unless you have it right.
33 would be that one.
What's that?
33-2023.
I got you. Resolution number 33-2023, a resolution authorizing the county administrator to sign necessary documents for deed of gift for real property from Fluvanna Rescue Squad Incorporated. Whereas Fluvanna Rescue Squad Incorporated approved transferring the following real property by deed of gift to Fluvanna County for use by the Fluvanna County Department of Emergency Services. Property identified as tax map number 22A66C and located at 4652 Cedar Lane Road, Kentstor, Virginia. And whereas the Fluvanna Rescue Squad Incorporated voted to transfer the property to the county by deed of gift at its meeting held on September 20th, 2023. Whereas the county is authorized under Virginia Code Section 15.2-2
1803 to accept the conveyance of property by deed of gift, and whereas the Board of Supervisors approved a resolution on September 20, 2023 to accept the conveyance of property by deed of gift, and whereas the Board of Supervisors desires to authorize the County Administrator to sign all necessary agreements, documents, to complete the transfer of the property. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Board of Supervisors of Blue Valley County that the County authorizes the County Administrator to sign all necessary documents for the conveyance of the property by deed of gift from the Fluvanna Rescue Squad Incorporated to the County for the use by the Fluvanna County Department of Emergency Services. The foregoing resolution was duly and regularly adopted by the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors at a meeting of the Board held on the 18th day of October 2023, and I move the Board of Supervisors approve a resolution authorizing the County Administrator to sign necessary documents for deed of gift for real property from Fluvanna Rescue Squad Incorporated for the use by the Fluvanna County Department of Emergency Services.
Okay, do we have a second? All right, we have a motion by Mr. Sheridan, second by Mrs. Gibbs. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye. So we're finished with new business. Now we're open our second public comment. If you'd like to come to the board, speak to the board, you may come at this time.
My name is James Jemster. I live on Jefferson Drive, and I do want to apologize to the board for any appalled messages you may have received from social media. I want to make sure that it's clear that I don't feel that the board is obligated in any way to make public comments accessible via Zoom. I just encourage folks to try and find a way. I know it was mentioned in the conversation at the last meeting that some people like VDOT or folks who may be able to add something of value to the conversation may be able to still tune in via Zoom. If we could extend that to someone who might ask to make public comment online ahead of time, that might be a solution. I don't know if that is possible or not. I just hope that we continue to explore this. But thank you so much for your time, and I just wanted to add that little bit to that conversation.
All right, thank you. Anyone else would like to speak? If not, I'll
Ms. Booker, this may be inappropriate if it is, I apologize. But I had another person text me about that, wishing that we can find a way to have that work.
Okay.
Brittany Gray, don't know that.
Now I will close the public comment, second public comment, and come back to the board with a can we adjourn now?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Lord Jesus.
What time is it? We are not leaving here.
Second. Second.
I told my family I'd be home.
All in favor?
Nine.
Aye.
Okay. Who did the first
motion? He made the motion. I seconded.
All right. Mr. O'Brien made a motion that we adjourn. And Mr. Sheridan seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay.